Who knows more about Munster rugby, me or you, Quinny?
Everyone has an opinion, don't they? Some of the opinions are waffle, but I'd like to think I know a lot.
The Red 78 with Alan Quinlan and Niamh Briggs. Subscribe to the Rugby Channel on the OTB Sports app and turn on your notifications now.
OTB AM with Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.
Right, Jerry, welcome along. It is Wednesday morning's OTB AM. It's Jerry Gilroy and Rory O'Connor with you this morning. Rory, good morning to you. How are you?
Great, Jared. Thanks. You.
An 11-0 win for the Republic of Ireland last night under lights in Talla. The type of cold, crisp, clinical football that we're very unused to seeing in this country.
Yeah, anytime you get a record win, it's pretty good going. And to see the big crowd there again and the momentum behind this team, it's pretty impressive to see what they're building. And, you know, obviously, we could probably dwell on the quality of the Georgian team and a couple of big scores around Europe last night, but that's not for this team and Vera Powell to worry about. They got to beat what's in front of them, and if it does come down to goal difference at the end of the day, it's going to be quite beneficial.
Yeah, look, I think the thing about the opposition is a point well made, right? And the comparisons are being made with how everybody else did against them, and it was the quality of the performance that they needed after the big letdown the last day. Like, I guess with a team like this where the improvements are coming off the back of a long period of not being very good or not getting good results or underperforming, then there are going to be setbacks. And it was two steps forward and one step back in the hole over the four games so far, where we were good against Finland, we were mediocre, not great against Sweden, but not bad because Sweden are a very good team. Then very disappointing against Slovakia and beat Finland. And it's like, okay, this is actually going the right direction. More than it's not.
Definitely, there definitely seems to be an upward trajectory, and we do have to apply the same kind of analytical standards to it. But you got to look at the base they're coming from, and when you see the joy on the faces at the end, and the fans didn't seem to care that there was no sympathy for Georgia in that stadium last night. There was a real seems to be a real bond between the people who are going to the games in Talla. They've built something very great. I mean, you would love in time to see them get to the Aviva with bigger crowds and to build beyond Talla, but right now it looks like a really good home for them. They seem to have a very loyal following who connect with the players, and the players just seem really happy to be there as well, which you want to see your teams turn up for international duty enthusiastic and wanting to be there, which isn't always the case, certainly with the men's team. And the women's team have had such difficulties in the past. They look like they're well catered for, they look like they're set up to succeed now. They've probably damaged their chances of getting to their end goal. But I suppose the overall goal of having a team to be proud of is, and having a backing behind them, is probably building, over the course of this qualification time, in terms of connecting with the fans, building a base and being stronger for not one campaign, but beyond that.
Yeah, and establishing, as you said, like a minimum expectation is that we go into these, and if everything breaks your way, you have a chance of winning it, but second is not guaranteed, but that's what you're like. That's what the expectation is. Anything below that is a failure, and they're the standards that you have to hold yourself to. So, that was the crack with that. One of the other big stories in the back of the papers today is that Roberto Mancini is being lined up to take over at Manchester United as part of the great Ralph Rangnick experiment. They're going to get this gegenpressing dude in, and he's going to be the godfather of the club. But then they're going to go for Roberto Mancini, who's the messianic, emotional type of manager. That
with a strong Man City past.
Yeah, it doesn't really seem to make that much.
It's quite on brand in terms of the
sell
cultural.
It to me. Come on.
Well, no, I don't think it's going to work, but it's quite on brand with the muddled cultural identity that Manchester United have right now. You know, there's no, like, Ferguson doesn't seem to have left much of a legacy in terms of the club. He's left a legacy in terms of their past, and they're almost this burden of they've become the theatre of dreams rather than Manchester United. You know, they've lost like the identity of the club. There may be some of his former employees in there, but it's very hard to know what they do. And Solskjaer came in and he was almost Fergie light, but didn't have the tactical capacity to lead the team. So why not bring in an Italian to work under a German, with a staff of English former Manchester United people who are going to be there regardless, and
really it seems that way.
Are just waiting for the next manager to come in to decide on whether they're going to get ketchup or not. It's like Mancini's, I think he's a good, he's a great forgotten man of the managers. Daniel Taylor's done some good work on kind of like, remember Mancini is actually a really good manager. And the Euros, I love the way this Italy team played, whereas I didn't love the way the City team played, but he got this collection of superstars together and got a title out of them. seemed to be quite acrimonious, you know, but I don't know how much of that was him and how much of that was the fact that he had Balotelli and this collection of...
The other thing is that his time there, they had already decided that they wanted Guardiola at some point, and they had got the architecture and the apparatus in place to get Guardiola with the sporting director and his staff. And so they were buying Guardiola-style players when Mancini was the manager. He knew he was on a... The clock was ticking, so I suspect that at the end that's what filtered into that. So, like, maybe Mancini is exactly the manager that they need.
Well, he certainly fits the profile in terms of status, because he's been famous since he was 11. You know, he's been this incredible superstar Italian footballer into a manager. He looks the part on the sideline. And Ragnick, for all that he has this unbelievable CV and has influenced so many other people. I mean, most people couldn't pick him out of a lineup. Maybe they could after a week of back pages, but really,
I still don't think
he's still, you know, he's quite peripheral. Sorry, he's quite obscure, and I'm not demeaning what he's done or accomplished in the game. And maybe he's the perfect figure to build their club into that identity.
Yeah,
but they maybe need for the fans and for the kind of, you know, the people who fell in love with Ole, like, you know, regardless of whether he was going to win or lose, who want an iconic messianic manager.
Yeah.
Maybe you need that. And maybe the next Manchester City manager is not the man who's going to deliver that for you. But, like, Mancini looks good on the sideline. And for a lot of football fans, that's a big part of it. And you know, people still think Mourinho's a good manager. You know?
Maybe for some players as well. A reminder, OTBAM brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. It's 7:36 this morning. We should talk about the big developing story is that you believe, it's your story.
Confirmed, yeah.
Right. So some Munster players, some coaching staff are in the air.
I'm doing the maths in my head. There's 48 of them over there. 14 are staying behind. So that's 34 have made their way
by Amsterdam. South Africa.
In a hotel room. Yeah, a hotel room in Cape Town. In a mandatory quarantine hotel in Cape Town. It's really unfortunate for those 14 people. I mean, they went over to play a game. At the time, things were looking pretty benign in the COVID world. South Africa seemed to be in a better place than Ireland. And then Omicron arrived halfway through the week. And suddenly, and they were on their way to the airport last Friday, the whole squad, when news came through, they'd pinged for one test. So they all went back to their hotel. That one test and a close contact were sent to another hotel, this place where you go when you're test positive. And then over a couple of days, they had 9 tests yesterday and a further 4. I'm losing track of days, but they've had 14 in total. So those 14 people are staying behind. And the rest were able to leave last night on a flight to Cape Town. From Cape Town to Amsterdam. I believe they landed in Amsterdam around... in about an hour or maybe an hour or two, and then they'll go home. So I mean, there was a plan for them to go to Carlton House and to train there for the week and try and prepare for the games. But from Munster's statement last night, they're going home to their families and they will basically go into their spare rooms for the next 10 days, which means they're very unlikely. You know, getting home is the important thing, but they do have a massive game on Sunday week.
It's Sunday week, right?
Sunday week. So there is time for them to come out of quarantine and play, but their training is going to be limited to their bedrooms and their back gardens.
Right.
So they... Are they going to be, like the Scarlets and Cardiff have both raised this as a major issue. Can they safely go out and play? Having not played, a lot of them haven't played since October 26th or October 23rd, apart from maybe a bit of AIL, which is, you know...
October 23rd is the ones who played for Munster.
For Munster. Right. The guys who are in South Africa largely haven't played since October 23rd. Maybe they played AIL, there was an A game in there, so there maybe been one game, but their conditioning has been affected by this period sitting in hotel rooms and in their spare rooms.
Yeah.
Is it safe for them to go out and play Wasps next week? There is enough players just about to field a team. They may need a bit of help from EPCR to fill a bench. There's like 9 or 10 internationals plus a contingent of academy players who didn't make the playing for South Africa. It's a very strange looking team. A lot of debutants.
You went through it in the Indo yesterday.
Yes, I did.
I mean, it's an interesting team. You'd be like,
well, you've Murray.
It was a pre-season friendly. You'd be like, oh, this is going to be very interesting to see how this young lad does in the midst of all those superstars.
Yeah, I mean, you're always hearing people say you put in the inexperienced guy in amongst an experienced team. So you might have an outside back who's playing outside Dielende and Earls.
Yeah.
With Conor Murray and Joey Carberry as his 9 and 10. It's not an appalling prospect, but I mean, it just depends on whether the player can cope with it. Wasps are not the best team. Like, it's not the worst team they could be facing, but they're still an experienced bunch. Like, they'll have Vea Fifita playing for them, who played for New Zealand against the Lions in 2017. He's one of the most powerful forwards in world rugby. And, like, Keane Tracy in today's paper has gone through a couple of the prospects. This could make someone's career.
They all sound very exciting.
Really, really highly rated young back row. I mean, if he comes on and he does well against them, well, suddenly he jumped a queue ahead of someone who's stuck in a hotel in South Africa, which is really unfair. they play Cast a week later, you know, if he does well, does he get another run? And suddenly is he, you know, there's a, and it would be the most on-brand Munster thing to do, to go to Osprey, or to go to Wasps with this team and win the European Cup game, like their latest miracle match. Like, they don't do quiet seasons. They're always just so dramatic, Munster. But this is...
It's already been quite a dramatic season with the news that the backroom team, which we thought was there for a couple of years, is already breaking up at least one of the key members is going.
At least, yeah.
Munster fullback Patrick Campbell will be familiar to followers of the Cork Minor football team. He won All Ireland with the Cork Minors in 2019, and is he possibly in?
I think he's not even in the European squad at the moment. But so they will need some help from EPCR, who because of their structure now, it's not to go into the weeds too much. They need the French league and the English league to sign off on it, and the French league is made up of clubs who. Last year, so if the game doesn't go ahead, they lose 28-0 automatically. Bonus point goes to Wasps. Munster on the back foot right away. Like, Toulon were thrown out of the tournament for having positive cases in Dublin last year. So there's not going to be a lot of sympathy for Munster in this scenario from France. So they need a bit of goodwill, whether that goodwill is there or not. Like, they have 19 or 20 players. Maybe a couple of the guys who are coming out of quarantine can go onto the bench
right,
to fill out that. Maybe they won't need the likes of Patrick Campbell. But like, there's a couple of really interesting stories in the Munster Academy. There's another guy who's a Clare minor as well, from a, you know, the GAA crossover point of view. Maybe they're getting a bit more success in that. But like, how exciting would it be to see these guys actually get a run in these games and thrive? At the same time, you don't want to see them getting run over either by, you know, former All Blacks who
you
know, eat them for breakfast.
Like, the players who stayed behind were largely the Ireland players who were in the squad. So, you know, with that, and obviously D'Alende. So with that and a few others who get out of quarantine, so it's not everybody coming out of quarantine, it's the people who feel like they're up to it and who are able to keep their conditioning high for the 10 days that they're at home. Not beyond the bounds of possibility that that team would be a reasonable team now that they're in the air and on their way.
Yeah, I think they get released from quarantine. There's a bit of debate over whether quarantine starts when you land or the day after when you land.
Okay.
So and the government haven't. I've been onto them trying to get clarification.
I'm not sure they know
what's expected. I think they are making up as they go along. But what Donnelly did say, no exceptions, and I think they've had to follow that rule on from that. So it's either Friday or Saturday. So even will they get a team run together before they go? Will the UK, well, the UK should be okay with them travelling. They'll need a PCR test to come home now, or an antigen test to come home, obviously, with the new rules, as will I. I'm still hoping to get over there, although I don't want to be stuck in England or France for Christmas in the next couple of weeks. So it's all, you just don't know what's going to happen. Like, the guys who have come home have had four PCR tests come back negative, so you'd hope that they are clear of it, that they've contained the spread and that they won't have any more cases when they land, because obviously that is a risk as well.
Oh, totally.
But it's just great they've gotten home. I mean, you feel for the 14 who are left behind, because that's pretty grim.
Yeah, it's no crack. It's the absence of crack. Right, and we'll keep you up to date with that as the story unfolds. And we'll talk more rugby a little bit later on. Here's what's coming up. We're going to react to Ireland's 11-0 victory over Georgia last night. Samuel Lockhurst of the Manchester Evening News is going to tell us how the deal was done to sign Ralph Radnick, and we'll get his reaction to the news this morning that Roberto Mancini is being linked with the gig. Jonathan Wilson is going to explain to us exactly how the Radnick blueprint will manifest itself with Ronaldo in the team or not. Chloe Mustaki is going to give us her review of the Republic of Ireland last night, and we'll talk with John Duggan just after nine. A roundup of all the big stories happening in rugby at 9:10 with Rory and Uli Hesse for more German football goodness coming your way. It's all Germany all the time these days here on the Off the Ball channels. Right, let's hear from Ireland captain Katie McCabe speaking with Nathan after their record-breaking 11-0 win last night.
11-0s don't come around every day. How enjoyable was that?
Yeah, look, it was really enjoyable. For us, it was about finishing this year off on a high, finishing off in second place in the group, and most importantly, the 3 points, which we got in the end.
After Thursday, you preached positivity, and it seems as though you walked the walk as well, because you came out tonight, it felt like with a real intent from the first minute. It wasn't a team that were coming out expecting to win this game easily.
No, look, obviously we needed to clean up on a few areas on Thursday, which we did. We looked at, we analysed it and got out on the training pitch and made sure we wanted to put on a good performance for all the fans coming tonight, everyone at home, which I hope they enjoyed. But, yeah, as I said, the main objective for us tonight was to make sure we got 3 points, and if it had been 1-0, I still would have been happy.
Because they've been tough opponents for other teams throughout this campaign. They've kept it tight against Sweden, against Finland, and we look at the conditions here. It was absolutely miserable at kickoff. It was one of those that could easily have become a bit of a dogfight.
Yeah, look, it was a night for the Irish. I think we're used to this weather. And as I said, we went in concentrating on ourselves. We looked at them and where we could hurt them. And I think we held our positioning and discipline and spread the ball really well tonight. And yeah, obviously we're clear cut on goal.
And very different sort of situation for you tonight in your position, not on the back foot at all, really a real opportunity to go and express yourself.
Yeah, look, obviously I enjoy being part of the attacks, helping the team create goal scoring opportunities. Luckily for us, Georgia only left the one up top, which meant the three girls at the back could defend. So yeah, it gave a bit more freedom for me on the left hand side. But look, it's not about me, it's about the team. We've seen Denise scoring a hat-trick there tonight. Absolutely brilliant. The girls coming off the bench, making an impact. Saoirse Noonan scoring her first goal. Kira Caruso scoring her first goal. Absolutely brilliant.
You're playing with world-class players week in, week out at Arsenal. Where does Denise O'Sullivan fit in those sort of conversations?
She's right up there. She's absolutely class. It's in these games where you can really see it. The touch off the ball, the link-up play I have with her. How much we're on the same page. I've been playing with Denise since I'm 14 or 15, so we know each other quite well. But yeah, Denise is a class act. I'm absolutely delighted for her to get the hat-trick tonight. She really deserves it. I can't speak highly enough for her.
Wanted one yourself.
Sorry?
Wanted one yourself as well.
Yeah, a little bit. to be honest, once we kept hitting them in, I didn't mind who was getting it. Really wanted Niamh Fahey to get one tonight. Actually, she's on 99 caps now, approaching her 100th. So, yeah, look, yeah, I'm happy with the result.
Yeah, 11-0, you're going to tend to be happy. Nathan, good morning to you. How are you?
Morning, lads.
It looked cold and miserable there. And I think, actually, the fact that a massive rain squall washed through an hour and a half before kickoff didn't help with the walk-up crowd?
No, and it was the same on Thursday night where the FAI had actually sold 6,500 tickets, were set for a record crowd and end up slightly less than the 5,200 that were at the Sweden game. But there was still, I'd say, up in 4,000 there last night. Conditions were as bad as I've been to at a match in the last couple of years. Gale force, driving wind, absolutely torrential rain. And the pitch wasn't in great condition by kickoff. There was a lot of surface water. So while in hindsight we look and say, yes, an 11-0 against Slovakia, you should be expecting to go and beat these teams well. So our Georgia have been improving. Georgia have been improving over the last campaign or so and had kept it tight against Sweden. It was a 4-0. It was a 3-0 against Finland, a 2-0 against Slovakia. So I think it was important for Ireland to break their resistance earlier to just take some positivity early in the game, bring the game to them, and whatever disappointment was there from Thursday, to banish that. And I think it'll do very well to pick any holes in last night's performance, which is unsurprising in an 11-0 victory.
Yeah. Can't do it on a wet Tuesday night in Tallaght Stadium. There's nowhere quite like it when the weather's in, rolling off the mountains like that. It's pretty grim.
Yeah, and I think the point you made about it was the quality of the football that they played early on, Nathan, that was, I guess, the most appealing characteristic, because there were doubts after the performance if any of the progress that we'd seen had actually been built on or if it was a little bit of a, you know, flash in the pan. It turns out that they are making progress.
Yeah, there was pressure because of the two drop points against Slovakia on Thursday, and while they were preaching positivity to the media, I think around the camp there was a huge disappointment that they missed out on a massive opportunity to take 6 points from these two games and really ease the pressure on themselves heading into 2022 when three of the next four games are away from home. So they needed to get at them early yesterday, and I think Denise O'Sullivan was the one who drove Ireland right from the start. You might have seen that shoulder in the first half. It was like watching The Rock. Sent this Georgian player absolutely flying, and within a couple of minutes you could see Denise O'Sullivan wanted to get on the ball all the time. And that was the biggest difference from Thursday to tonight, that Megan Connolly and Denise O'Sullivan ran the game in the middle of midfield. They were close together. They had added Rarisha Littlejohn, who also had a fine game in there as well, and just dominated possession. Never gave Georgia a chance on the ball at all. Passed it quickly, got it to their talented attacking players, got Katie McCabe in. And when McCabe and O'Sullivan are playing well, Ireland can achieve a lot. And the big question mark still, I think, is against the better teams, how do they get O'Sullivan involved in the game like she did last night? It'll never be that easy. But how do you get her involved in that final third more often instead of dropping deep where it can all be a little bit frantic? And how do you get Katie McCabe into that attacking position? Because where she was last night is where Ireland fans want to see her, where she's at her more dangerous. But in the majority of the games in this campaign so far, she's been totally on the back foot and struggling to get out of her own half. So how you transfer that to a game away against Sweden or at home against Finland is the big task for Vera Pauw.
Are they better set up to play away from home then if they're not expected to be on the front foot?
I don't know. I think you want them to be on the front foot. And Ireland have gone down a path of playing very difficult games. They've got some friendlies in February where Vera Pauw was saying last night again she's looking to play three games and again looking to get difficult opponents, that she feels actually a performance like that couldn't really happen unless you're playing the tougher teams, unless you're really having to scrap for possession all the time. But they clearly there's a lack of trust. Maybe it's a deserved lack of trust in some of the creative players of allowing them further forward, like playing five at the back basically at home against Slovakia. The back three works just fine, but when Katie McCabe and Onya O'Gorman, or whether it's Jessica Zhu, are pinned back in their own half, it just feels as though it's going to be very hard for the midfielders to gain any control. We saw Heather Payne, who wasn't there last night, basically playing that sort of traditional Irish striker's role of, you know, being busy and covering every blade of grass without ever really getting a touch in around the opposition penalty area. So I think the next stage is for them to have some more control, like Sweden away. Sweden away is as tough a game as you can find, you know, the second best team in the world. You know they're going to dominate possession, but when you get a chance to get on it, having enough players in the right positions to do it, which I just don't think they've really had in this campaign so far. And it's probably one of the reasons I think that there's been a bit of pressure mounting, because a lot more people are taking interest in the team, a lot more people are going to Tallaght to watch them, and then they're watching it and thinking, actually, you know, is this what we want or what we expect? But Vera Pauw will point to the results and say they're second in the qualification table. If the results go the exact same way in the next stage, Ireland will be in a playoff, which will put them in with a brilliant chance to get into a first ever major finals.
Yeah, the playoffs are quite convoluted, and so we can come back to those, unless you have a Nations League style Kevin Kilbane explainer ready at the fingertips, do you?
The playoffs, well, obviously all the teams that win the groups go into the playoffs, and then for the playoffs, the second place teams go into a draw, and at the moment there's what, 9 second place teams go into that draw.
All the teams who win qualify.
All the teams that win qualify, and there's going to be 2 rounds in the playoff as well. And you want to be one of the best playoff teams, basically, to make life that little bit easier for yourself. So that's why even that Slovakia game is a disappointment if you finish second in the group. Like, goal difference probably shouldn't be relevant. I know Ireland racked up a big goal difference last night. Probably shouldn't be relevant, really, because it'll be your head-to-head, more than likely, against Finland that would take precedence.
Okay. Our next competitive game is in Sweden in April. And then after that, the next game is in Georgia in June. And there's another game in September then, away to Finland. And we finished with that doubleheader is in September, away to Finland and Slovakia at home. Sorry, away to Finland and Slovakia.
The other way around, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. Finland at home and Slovakia away. These friendlies are actually going to end up being quite important then. When you're talking about the style of play at the moment, did we play 3 at the back last night, but it just ended up being a 3-5-2 because we were in possession of the ball the whole time? Like, is the 3 at the back, that's what we're going to do, and it's going to try and be adaptable to whatever challenge we face?
Yeah, I think if you were ever to change away from a 3-5-2, last night was the time to do it. It was more a 3-4-2-1 probably last night, where Lucy Quinn and Denise O'Sullivan were pushed right up by Hind, Kira, Carusa. And like, the difference between a 3-5-2 and a 5-3-2 is probably pretty seismic for a team, in that because Katie McCabe is Ireland's outstanding player, that's the difference between her playing as a left back and playing as a left winger. And her playing as a left winger gives Ireland a creative outlet out there that's as good as any team in the world. Whereas if she's stuck inside her own half, yes, it's great to have that defensive solidity, and Ireland have an incredible amount of experience in the back. I think that is the key, that actually it needs to be more of a 3-5-2. I think last night she brought in Diane Caldwell on the left-hand side in place of Savannah McCarthy, probably knowing that the pace of Savannah McCarthy wasn't going to be needed as much if Katie McCabe did roam forward down the left-hand side, because Georgia played one up front. I don't think had a single shot on target, maybe one in the entire game, but you know, never were going to put any great pressure. So McCabe and Zoo could do what they wanted. They never had to help out in the defence at all. But like, Vera Powell is incredibly set in her ways. She knows exactly what she wants to do. She isn't for turning. I don't think she takes much heed of any criticism about style of play or anything like that. In one way, it feels as though it's a little bit reminiscent of times of Trapattoni, that you know, she will look at the players and the quality of the players and point out that they're not at the level of a Sweden or a Netherlands and the best teams in the world, and that this is a system that gets the very best out of them. And it's not about style. It's not about attractive football. It's about qualification. And it's a conversation we're well used to in this country about football. Can we have both? Can we have both?
How do the players feel about that?
Well, the players, when results are going all right, like in any team, seem to be buying into it. You do get the sense that there's a feeling of they know that they need to get Katie McCabe into the game more. Like, McCabe could play anywhere up the left-hand side. She could play in a more central role. And I don't think there's much room for dissent in that Republic of Ireland squad, as we've seen previously. So it'd take a brave player to speak out and say they weren't happy with the system or they weren't happy with their position, because I would imagine they wouldn't be long in that starting 11. So I think the players are doing what they're told. The results are starting to improve. And while they do, they'll all get along just okay. But if things start to fall apart in the second half of this campaign, I think the pressure from the outside will increase as to what's going on with Katie McCabe. How did they get O'Sullivan and McCabe linking up more often? And I think there's no doubt there must be times. There's no question that that match on Thursday night, Katie McCabe must have been frustrated coming off, knowing the influence she could have and how little influence she actually did have. We saw with the equaliser that she scored the quality that was there, but they just didn't get her into the game enough. So they need to find a way that they're not reliant on what the opposition do to get Katie McCabe in. And I do think we're going to spend the entire campaign talking about Katie McCabe and Denise Sullivan and focusing on those two players and how involved they are, because the more involved they are, the better Ireland play.
The difference you talked about there between 3-5-2 and 5-3-2, how much of that is down to like winning your winning your duels in the actual match itself? Like, how much of it is predetermined? You're not going to, what we're saying when you're 5-3-2 is you're going to play left back tonight. You're not going to cross the halfway line. Like, that, it doesn't strike me that that was the game plan at home to Slovakia, was to be conservative and try and keep it tight and nick one, because we were supposed to be the oppressor in that one. So, like, what, where's the disconnect between the 3-5-2, 5-3-2 thing from that perspective? And do any, is it part of the players also standing up and saying, actually, no, we have the quality to be able to get on the ball and take those risks and pass it? Because it's not like they're not being told not to pass the ball.
No. And they're not going old-style route one all the time either. It just seems to be at times they can't get enough bodies in the middle to take control of the game. I was talking briefly to Denise O'Sullivan afterwards about the difference, and she said it was just so frantic and helter-skelter on Thursday night that they never got control of the ball. They never got space. The two holding midfielders never had enough time on the ball to pick out the right pass. And Everton was rushed, which meant they constantly ended up turning over possession, which meant it was constantly scrappy, which I would assume then meant that, you know, Katie McCabe couldn't take the risk of stepping forward when you can't trust at times that your central midfield is going to keep hold of the ball. Yeah. Because suddenly you find, like what happened with the goal, where you find actually everyone is charged forward, you lose possession of midfield, and suddenly there's this wide open space. So there's definitely a balance to be got as well. But maybe last night, Vera Powell stumbled on something with Risha Littlejohn coming into the midfield as well, and herself and Connolly and O'Sullivan linked up brilliantly and had exactly those sort of nice little triangles and were able to control the game. The midfield, the defenders, three centre halves, were able to step forward. With three centre halves, you think one of them should always be able to step forward. Like, Mifahi spent the majority of the game in the opposition half as well, that they were able to crowd them out of it. So maybe they just need to take a few more risks in general to make sure that they do get the results. Because I think the one home game they have is against Finland. Like, that is going to be a nervy, nervy September, you feel, on the assumption that maybe Ireland, you know, go to Sweden and you would expect Sweden to win that, but likewise you'd expect Ireland to go and win in Georgia. A home game against Finland and a away trip to Slovakia in the space of 5 days at the end of this campaign are going to be absolutely huge. And you just hope by then Ireland are in a position where actually in that home game against Finland, they do have a far greater level of control in midfield, more like last night, less like what we saw on Thursday night.
Is there a danger in making tactical amendments based on an 11-0 win over a team that were down to 10 players for so long?
There probably is, but I guess there wasn't a massive change in that. She did play the three at the back. If they'd gone with four at the back last night, we might have been thinking, well, is actually this the way forward? And you're going, well, what was the quality of the opposition? Maybe Vera Powell looked at it and said this was more of a mentality thing, that there was some nerves on Thursday night, that, again, from very early in the first 5 minutes of that game, you were looking at Slovakia and thinking, ooh, they're a little bit better than we expected. They're a little bit more physical than we expected. Whereas last night, there was no question from the first couple of minutes in the game that Denise Sullivan was going to be the best player on the pitch. So maybe they just need that bit of a mentality shift from the start of the game and a bit of confidence to say, we're going to go and take it. I think she will stick with the three at the back. I think she will stick with the wing backs. And it will just be like, is it a mentality shift? Is it figuring out as the game goes on? I just cannot see a situation where Vera Powell is saying in any of those games to Katie McCabe, you sit yourself in the opposition half, no matter what happens. I think it'll be the exact same again of figure out how the game is going. And if she finds herself pegged back, she'll find herself pegged back. And it doesn't look as though there's going to be any change of position for Katie McCabe between now and the end of the campaign.
All right, two quick things. Shane on YouTube says, can Nathan give an update on Oisin Mullen? You're unprepared for this. I didn't tell you it was coming. There's a lot of hope that maybe Oisin Mullen won't be going to Australia, but presumably there's just going to be a delay in when he goes. It's not like this deal is off, is it?
No, there's as usual in Mayo, there's a lot of rumours swirling, and he's had his injury problems during the summer. Was there a problem with the medical? It seems to be more maybe an issue with the contract, and that the contract hadn't been fully signed, and that maybe a final agreement wasn't completely in place, and that it still hasn't been signed, and he's once again going through the fine details and maybe reconsidering his position.
Right, so you're saying there's a chance?
Saying there's a chance, but it has gone very quiet, and obviously the club put up that it was a done deal, but it seems from Oisin Mullen's side it's not 100% a done deal yet.
Totally unconnected to this, the Sunday Business Post had a large feature on the re-emergence of Tim O'Leary at the weekend. The, I want to say Mayo businessman, but he's not a Mayo businessman. He's English with Mayo roots, isn't that right?
He's of the world.
Yeah, a world trader. An England football fan, though, as we know.
Well, that's, you know, Mayo people, they spread their roots, and some of them end up as English football fans, some of them don't. But yes, he is of Mayo. And he has emerged, re-emerged, you say?
He's coming back, isn't he? He's making a comeback.
I don't know about that.
Well, that was certainly...
I don't know about that. There's changes afoot at the top of Mayo. There's obviously going to be a new county board chairperson, so maybe with all that happening, there may be an opportunity for Tim O'Leary to step back in.
Certainly makes life a bit more interesting.
I think something we should look at and for the next couple of days is a sort of Father Ted style and now to the liars segment about all the various different county board reports that come out.
Careful now. Careful now.
They are. I'm not talking about the county board chairman. I'm just wondering. I think it's incredible how they are sort of given this pulpit where they can come out and basically express their views in every part of the game. I think they make incredibly interesting reading. We might do a highlights section of them in the next week when they're all in.
So they're Father Ted doing the Now to the Liars bit. They're the
exactly.
Lawyers. Okay, grand. Just so are the lawyers who are like, oh.
It's the quietest time of the season as well, so they always get so much space.
It's like, amazing,
there's nothing else going on in the GA world. Apart from
was it Mayo's turn? Are Mayo in the papers today talking about
the... They go with John Small incident again, didn't they? Like, you know, let's revisit this while it's 5 months
on. We definitely need to bring all that stuff back out, because let's face it, there's nothing else to talk about. And then the other thing is Rafa Benitez returning to... it's obviously at Goodison tonight, but it's his first proper Premier League derby where he's going to be in the dugout for Everton against Liverpool. Will the Liverpool fans chant his name? Yes, they will, because things aren't going so well for Everton at the moment.
Yeah, I think they'll make the most of this opportunity to tell Rafa Benitez he'll always have their love as he maybe comes to the end of his time at Everton.
What are the odds on
agent, Rafa?
What are the odds on a Rafa's at the wheel, Rafa's at the wheel chant going up at some point?
Is the at the wheel line the most annoying in football right now?
I know, it was great. At the end of
it's right up there.
At the end of the Solskjaer thing, it was that song, the way it was sung by the visiting fans or the away fans, or the home fans, depending on who Man United were playing every week. That was brilliant. That was the absence of fans in stadiums last year and the fake crowd noise. You never got the abuse of the opposition manager, which was the thing that tilted everything off. It was like, Oh, everybody's taking the piss out of us.
I meant you could just move on from a 7-1 or whatever the Liverpool Aston Villa score was, and it just was.
Yeah.
You know, it just meant you could park it.
Yeah.
There was no aftermath. There was no scenes.
And there's no build up. Like week after week after week, the slow, steady decline, and then the car crash that was. Ollie's at the wheel. At the wheel. Ollie's at the wheel. It was brilliant. I thought so. Yes, it's annoying when you see everybody saying it and taking the piss out of Rio Ferdinand, whatever. Like, Carragher trying to steal it at the weekend was like, he needs someone better on a social media team. But I think that the away fans, like, I would not be terribly surprised with Liverpool fans when it's 3-0 tonight, do a cheeky little, Rafa's at the wheel. At the wheel.
Yeah, if they find themselves 3-0 up at Goodison Park, I'd say, everything is on the table from a Liverpool supporters' point of view.
They're going to win 3-0, right? Like, it will be 3-0 at some point tonight. Unless Pickford.
Listen, Everton won last year, obviously, and their record in the derby is absolutely atrocious. It does feel more like a couple of seasons ago when Liverpool went to Goodison Park and scored 5 and just absolutely railroaded them. So I wouldn't be at all surprised if it was a comfortable win for Liverpool tonight.
All right. Nathan, good stuff. Thanks a million.
Cheers, lads.
Cheers,
Nathan. It's Nathan there, who was at the game last night. 11-0. We carried it live on Off the Ball for you. A reminder, OTBAM brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. We've got a packed show still to come on OTBAM. We're going to hear from Irish footballer Chloe Mustaki. Jonathan Wilson joins us. And up next, Samuel Luckhurst, Chief Man United writer at the Manchester Evening News.
OTB AM.
There's retirements left, right and centre at the minute. It's that time of the year.
Christmas around the corner, Tommy. That's what happens. Lads get excited.
This is
the not going back in January. Knocking on the head.
This is the Mannerly time. This is the Mannerly time to retire. Not like, you know, the week before the All Ireland final or the second week in January.
All that has happened is people have come in here, right? listen to the pod for the last 29 episodes. And seeing the lifestyle that Paddy Andrews has had since he left the
There's not much crack the last few weeks, lads.
He's wearing a Roddy Collins jacket. He's got his teeth done like Ross from Friends. He's looking magnificent and he's ready to go.
He looks like he's in his 20s again. What a man. Just for the pod, lads.
Just for the pod.
That's the Football Pod with Paddy and Andy. Episode 29 is available. The former Antrim footballer Paddy Cunningham joins the lads for a chat about his time with Antrim, his love for the Predator Mania football boots and the untapped GAA potential in Belfast. It's 8:07 this morning here on OTBM, and I'm delighted to say Samuel Luckhurst is with us, Chief Manchester United writer at the Manchester Evening News. Good morning to you, Sam. How are you getting on?
Good morning. Very well, thank you. Thank you for having me on.
A nice quiet time for you over the last few months, I suspect, as you were trying to read the room and see exactly what was going to happen. Can you just take us back to the decision to go with Ranić? How close were anybody else to actually getting the job, in your estimation?
I don't think any really came any close to Ranić and his interview pitch. Obviously, there were some names that emerged before his name on the Wednesday. I think I did the story that he was the preferred candidate. You had Ernesto Valverde. I think Lucien Favre was another name that came out. The shortlist might have been as many as 5, but those were the two names, as well as Rangnick, that I was aware of, at least. And really, Rangnick came in on the Tuesday, I think it was. He flew in and did his pitch, and they were very impressed. And on the back of that, they decided that he was the one they wanted as an interim. If they couldn't get Pochettino, which they couldn't, Paris Saint-Germain were just playing hardball there. By the time Rangnick flew back to his home, the contract offer had arrived. He didn't like it. He rejected it. United thrashed out these revised terms that included the 2-year consultancy role. And he liked that and he's accepted that. And we're just waiting for him to arrive now.
In terms of that 2-year consultancy role, do we know what shape it's going to take and what influence he'll have? Is it about transfers? Is it about coaching? What is it about?
Well, United have been very vague at the moment, and I don't think we'll have an inkling as to the specificity of it until we speak to Rangnick, which still might be a while, given that he's not going to be in charge for the Arsenal game. If he is in charge for the Palace game, because of the timings of that, where United are playing a Thursday this week, they won't have a pre-match press conference on the Friday. That's just the way United operate. So in terms of that consultancy role, the irony is that they overlooked Rangnick and other candidates for the football director role, which is occupied by John Murtagh, because they were deemed to be too synonymous with recruitment. They wanted someone who had a broader remit, who had more experience of dealing with the administrative side of football at the club. And Murtagh was in charge of recruiting the women's team in 2018. And at one point, he managed the academy as well. So this is a big about turn, because Rangnick, clearly, given his hit rate, is going to have some input in recruitment. And given United's hit rate with recruitment, even in recent years, where it's seemed better than it has been before Ole Gunnar Solskjaer came in, it's still not actually been that good if you look at the way some players have been playing over the last year.
Samuel, when you say they liked his pitch and he flew in for an interview, who's actually in the room? Who's making that call?
Well, Ed Woodward is still making that call, which I know is going to baffle a lot of people, because he's serving out his notice. He's still due to step down in April. John Murtagh is still involved. I say still involved. He's been at the club for 8 years, John Murtagh, but where they finalised this structure in March with him as football director and Darren Fletcher as technical director, they see those two as quite key to the decision-making process. That said, a lot of people I've spoke to in the industry who've had FaceTime with Murtagh and Fletcher, more FaceTime than I have, anyway, as a journalist, are still a bit baffled by their roles. Fletcher's a technical director, but I can't think of another technical director in football who's pulling his boots on, getting involved with training, and is now in the dugout a hell of a lot as well. He's watched games from the press box with the analysts this season. He's watched games from the director's box with Richard Arnold. And now he's in the dugout. So there's some confusion as to his role. But United seem to be at pains to justify the existence of this technical director role and the football director role as well. In fairness to John Murtagh, who's in the latter role, he was one who was actually pushing for Rangnick, or so United say anyway. He met him in 2019 where he did a reconnaissance fact-finding mission at Leipzig. He met him again during this pitch that Rangnick gave last week to be the interim manager. Richard Arnold was the other one involved, the managing director, who everybody expects to replace Woodward as executive vice chairman next year.
So Richard Arnold's background is actually on the commercial side of the business, and he's been hugely prominent in transforming Manchester United into the juggernaut that they're in. And in succession terms, it actually probably makes sense to have a load of football people around him so he can continue to focus on that and make sure that the business of the football side of things is run properly. Whereas with Woodward, it was kind of like he's a little bit of everything, certainly believed himself to be a football... He believed himself to have enough knowledge to be able to contribute when the football decisions were being made, and we've seen that that has not worked out. So I can see some sense in having beefing up the intellectual quotient of the football side of things. I still don't understand fully what the roles of the three men were going to be when you have a technical director and a football director and now a chief football consultant, or a senior football consultant, I think was the exact terminology.
Yeah, it is baffling at times. It can get confusing. The line of reporting is effectively still to Woodward. Woodward rests below Joel and Avram Glazer, who are the only Glazer siblings that have any real dealings with anyone at the club. They're the ones who are listed as the co-chairman. The other four siblings are just shareholders in the club, effectively. So Murtagh will just report into Woodward. I don't know yet, nobody's actually specified yet, whether Rangnick will report into Murtagh or whether Murtagh will report into Rangnick. Given that Rangnick's role is on a two-year basis, it could be longer than that, don't know. But they probably still need to clarify that. The fact that Murtagh is happy for Rangnick to come in, even though from the outside you might have thought Rangnick would be coming in and treading over his toes, I suppose bodes well, but it doesn't bode well for this structure that they finalised in March, which they thought was a really big progressive step forward. And again, they've been at pains to stress how key Fletcher and Murtagh have been in this process of recruiting Rangnick as interim manager. But going ahead, ultimately, the main kingmaker next year is going to be another chap from the University of Bristol who, if you speak to people and they're quite candid with you, will tell you that his preferred sport is rugby, which has been the case with Woodward. That's apparently the case with Arnold as well. And when you just look at some of the things Arnold has said, whether it's speaking about the commercial side of United or the football side of United, he puts his foot in his mouth a hell of a lot more than Woodward ever has. And during these conference calls, whereas Woodward now just sticks to speaking about football, it's Arnold who, you know, gush about all the guff about the app rating or the Chinese pipeline or the next noodle partner. So unfortunately for Richard Arnold, when it does come to him replacing Ed Woodward, there are going to be a hell of a lot of humiliating quotes that are going to haunt him, that he's going to struggle to live down, unfortunately for him.
Maybe the beefed up football side is the type of thing where he doesn't talk about football and the three lads go forward, and that's the Holy Trinity as it goes. On that then, who will be responsible for recruitment?
Well, it's... How long have you got, really? The manager has always had a veto on whether a target should be signed or not. The recruitment department have a veto as well. The recruitment department is headed up by the technical chief scout, Mick Court. When we got wind of this recruitment department, you wondered whether it existed, whether it was just something that was floating in the ether and was used as an excuse for that pretty fraught summer they had under Mourinho in 2018, where he was determined to have a centre-back signed. And in the end, the word that came out from United was that they were vetoing his targets and his suggestions. So again, this is another convoluted process in that you've got the football director who the manager will report into. So for the next 6 months or so, that will be Rangnick. The recruitment department gather data. There are sometimes monthly meetings on recruitment. They'll have started preparing for next summer's transfer window in September. So that's the way they should be. Any football club should be going through that process. But again, where you've got a manager in charge until the end of the season, then he's a consultant. It's a strange dynamic there in terms of preparing for recruitment next summer, because a new manager will be inheriting those players. I don't think too many managers will be concerned about the situation with possible outgoings, because United, by all accounts, seem to have just given up the ghost on Paul Pogba, given up the ghost on Jesse Lingard in terms of signing new contracts. Enzo Cavani and Juan Mata are well into their 30s. They barely figure as it is. Clearing the decks should be welcomed by whichever manager comes in. But that manager is still going to come in quite late on when it comes to recruitment and planning, because United like to try and execute deals in February and have deals in place. So this is still 3 or 4 months before the new manager is due to come in, unless they have a Tottenham-style scenario where they're going round in circles, being rejected by managers left, right and centre. So for the next 6 months, Rangnick will have heavy input into recruitment, as you'd imagine he should do, given his background and his hit rate and the players that he's unearthed. But there is still the possibility that someone in the recruitment department will veto that. Although, given the egos there, given from what I've heard about Rangnick and how controlling he can be, I don't think anyone in the recruitment department has got a profile that could really get away with vetoing him. But according to United, that's what they did with Mourinho.
What does success look like for Rangnick then, Samuel? Like, is it just getting into the Champions League, or is he trying to do that while also reforming the football side of the club from top to bottom? Or does that process start when he becomes the consultant?
It's an interesting question, because when they sat Solskjaer, the background briefing they gave on it was so glowing that you wondered if they had sacked him. They talked about how he'd restored the soul to the club, all these academy graduate debutants. But when you look at it in terms of this whole restored the soul, I don't really think it stacks up. I mean, this year you had the Super League fiasco kickoff, and he ended up defending Joel Glazer to some supporters who stormed the training ground pace. His tenure ended up with him getting booed as well. Last season was a pretty soulless season because there were no crowds present at all, bar the odd result. I mean, it's a bit like Casablanca. They'll always have Paris. It's that result against PSG which effectively secured his position as permanent manager. But with Rangnick, because of the way United were and because of the way the season's gone, I do think if they finished top four and that was it, no trophy, the way the worldview of the Glazers, of Ed Woodward, of Richard Arnold, they would probably view that as a success. And I don't think many United supporters would view it as a success. It's not like they're miles off when it comes to qualifying for the Champions League. They've still got a Champions League knockout tie to play. There's an FA Cup campaign. They're not going to win the Premier League, obviously, which is already a failure because that's what they were gearing up for this season. It was to at least challenge for the Premier League, and that challenge has ended before it even started. So it's got to be a top four place, because if they miss out on Champions League football again this season, it's just happening too much, and it's not a great position for the next coach to inherit, because then you've got a big player like Cristiano Ronaldo who's completely synonymous with the Champions League. Is he actually even going to settle for Europa League football next season? Would he want out? That becomes another subplot altogether, and it just makes it for very shaky foundations for that next new permanent manager.
The Telegraph this morning are reporting that Roberto Mancini is in the frame as a potential long-term manager. Is that goer, do you think? Would that make sense in the current system?
I'm not surprised that Mancini's name has emerged, and that he's got a great affinity with Manchester, and there are guys that he's dealt with in the Manchester pack before who are still reporting on both clubs. Italy might not qualify for the World Cup, so if they go out and he's pretty much out of a job, really. If Italy don't qualify for successive World Cups, that it was disastrous enough when they didn't qualify for Russia, never mind in Qatar in November next year. So it would be a strange position to be in that clearly I think Mancini would like to manage Italy at a World Cup, but if he doesn't, he's got to look and see what's out there. It would be a strange dynamic if Italy went out of the World Cup before it's even started, and United decided, you know what, he's the guy to bring in. And also, I think his character, again, United have wanted to go for compliance. They've kind of moved away from that now with Rangnick, who is a controlling personality. But I think Mancini is possibly a bit too antagonistic for them, similarly to Conte as well, which is why they didn't go for him.
Yeah, exactly. Samuel, great to have you with us. That was brilliant. Really fascinating insights. Thanks a million for joining us.
Thank you very much. Enjoy your day.
That's Samuel Luckhurst there, Chief Manchester United writer for the Manchester Evening News. Loads of interesting little nuggets there. Pogba essentially gone.
Yeah.
Jay Ling's essentially gone. So we'll see.
A lot of wage bill.
Yeah. And getting...
But no transfer fees.
It's true, no transfer fees, but... why they gave Mata a new contract, that all seemed like the emotion of the whole thing was more important than the finances and the facts. And right, here is actually Jonathan Wilson's going to be with us in 1 second. We're going to talk to him about the actual style of play. Good question. What is success? Not blowing up in their faces over the next few months, that kind of constitutes success at this stage, right?
I was scrambling for the league table there to see how far off they are, but the Champions League seems like, I presume they're looking for some sort of Tuchel effect, that he can galvanise the squad, create a system, and go on a run in a knockout competition, and you know, he obviously has the pedigree to be successful, although he hasn't won an awful lot in his career, but he's influenced a lot of winning coaches, so that's what they're hoping for. But I presume it's getting back to the Champions League from the club's point of view to maintain their status, so that when they're appointing a manager and they're trying to keep Ronaldo, they have that in their pocket. But yeah. I don't know. I mean, that's what the club's looking for. I don't know what the fans want. The fans seem quite happy with Solskjaer as they slid down the table. So it's.
They weren't allowed not to be happy.
Yeah.
It was like it was kind of too much self-loathing involved. But he's one of us. So
they need an overhaul of the footballing cultural architecture of the entire club. But whether the will is there, there seems to be just the names that were coming out there of people who are actually making decisions. Just is baffling. They need a football director who can actually clear house and
a football director. OTBAM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. I'm delighted to say we have with us now Jonathan Wilson, a football writer with The Guardian, who just this week was crowned Football Writer of the Year for the third time at the FSA Awards. Jonathan, first off, congratulations. Well done.
Oh, thank you very much. That's very kind.
You look great in your tuxedo alongside Miguel Delaney, and he put up a good show of being supportive of you in your hour of success.
Yeah, well, it was very nice. We were sitting together at the same table, and I'd have been delighted had he won. and just as delighted as he was that I won.
We've just asked a good question of Samuel Luckhurst. It's not my question, so I can say it was a good question. What does success look like for Ralph Rangnick over the next 4.5, 5 months? What does he have to do to make everybody think that was a good idea?
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, it is a good question because I think the answer is really not obvious or not easy. I suppose in very simple terms, they need to finish fourth. They need to be in the Champions League next season. So they're, 5 points off at the minute? I don't think you look at those teams that they're competing with and think that any of them are significantly better than United. If you look at West Ham or Arsenal or Wolves, you think, well, it's entirely possible given this United squad that they could overhaul them. But actually, I think his job is more in the longer term. I think it's the consultancy that will determine whether this is a success or not. And that's where Rangnick has been successful in the past, that in terms of trophies that he's won, he's a little bit like Marcelo Bielsa, that he hasn't got this great list of honours. I mean, he got Hanover promoted, he won the Cup with Schalke, and that's pretty much it, which for a 63-year-old doesn't sound like a great body of work. But where he's been incredibly influential and incredibly successful is in essentially planting the seed of pressing in German football. So in the late 80s, when he was really developing this idea of pressing, you know, he famously, February 1983, he's player coach of this sixth-tier West German side, Viktoria Backnang. They play a friendly against Valery Lobanovsky's Dynamo Kiev, and he can't believe what's going on, to the point that when the ball goes out of play for throw-in in the first half, he stops and counts how many players Dynamo have because he can't quite believe they've only got 11. And that was his sort of, you know, scales from the eyes moment, his Damascene moment of, you know, pressing can do something really, really exciting. And that wasn't part of German football at all at that point. But he sort of begins that process of instilling pressing. And even late 90s, you know, there's the famous TV appearance where he tries to explain a back four, he tries to explain zonal marking. And he's sort of laughed out of town as this nerd who doesn't really connect with the values of German football, which at the time were man-to-man marking, physical courage, leadership. But time has proved him right. And it took for sort of the next generation, people like Jurgen Klopp, to really take that into the mainstream. But he's been there in the background all the time and very directly controlling things, particularly at Leipzig, where he was head of football development for the whole Red Bull group of clubs. So he was coach of Red Bull twice very briefly, which I guess is the thing that's analogous to what's going to happen at United, where he essentially kept the seat warm until he could bring in a new candidate in his image. And that's what slightly concerns me with this word consultancy, because I don't quite know what the parameters of that are going to be. And I don't know why, if you're United and you want Rangnick to rebuild your club in his image, in the way that he's built RB Leipzig, why would you not make him director of football? Now, I know they appointed John Murta in March. Murta, who came from Everton, is somebody who doesn't have a huge public profile. It's not entirely clear what he's done so far. Was there no way that Rangnick has had a much more formal role? Now, maybe consultant means he will be running everything. I think there's a danger consultant means he gets slightly pushed to the side.
It's really going to... That will be the most fundamentally interesting question that gets answered here. And we just had Samuel Luckhurst on. He was saying that, he covers Manchester United for the Manchester Evening News. He can't really tell what the difference in the role between Darren Fletcher and Murta is, except that recently Fletcher has been involved on a day-to-day basis putting on his boots, and that's not just a post-Solskjaer sacking thing, that actually he'd been watching matches alongside Richard Arnold, he'd been watching matches from the press box, he'd been eyes and ears on match day, which is not really what you would have expected a football director or a technical director to do. So maybe there is room for a third person in that to kind of guide the two slightly less experienced men about how you build a club in the image of Red Bull. Is there a way that they can all make that relationship work?
Well, I think there is a way, but it just makes me uneasy when roles are not clearly defined. I think we saw that, for instance, at Arsenal in the post-Wenger era, when they brought in Mislintat, and you had even Gazidis, and you had these the three figures there who nobody seemed quite to know what each of them were doing. They ended up all sort of falling out with each other, and they've all left the club now.
Yeah.
So like that great triumvirate they put in place just didn't work. So it's just that word consultant makes me very nervous. I wish it was clearer what that is. But I mean, I think the point you make about experience, I think, is absolutely a key one, that Michael Carrick and Darren Fletcher clearly both were extremely good midfielders. I'm sure they know what they're doing. I think we've seen actually some steel from Carrick in the last week that maybe we didn't know that he had. But they're really learning their trade. So, again, I don't know what influence Mertes had directly. And he is more experienced. But Rangnick, at 63, is extremely experienced. And that, I think, is a very useful virtue for them to add.
Has he ever experienced a dressing room quite like this, though?
No, probably not. And the truth is that when he was at Schalke, which is the highest profile job he's had, he really didn't enjoy it. He was head coach there. And you might remember he was in charge of Schalke when they lost to United in that Champions League. Semi-final, I think. But he really didn't like the pressure of that. He didn't like the scrutiny. He didn't like being front and centre all the time. So I think it makes sense that he's taken the job on an interim basis. I don't think he would want it longer term. I think he doesn't enjoy that. He likes being the guy in the background, so he can have his influence. He can run things his way, but without having to face the media, without having to do that the very front-facing role that a modern coach has to do. But this is a difficult dressing room. You're right. Yeah, I'm sure he's dealt with big personalities before, but I'm not sure there's any bigger personality in modern football than Ronaldo. And that is a clear point of conflict, because Ronaldo's football and Rangnick's football do not seem in any way congruent.
Non-simpatico, it seems.
Yeah, absolutely.
The quote from Maurizio Sarri after his time at Juventus about Ronaldo being actually like a multinational organisation that you're managing the whole time, I think everybody goes, oh, no one player is bigger than the club. But at the moment, Cristiano Ronaldo's right there with Manchester United. His influence and interests are hugely important. And that's kind of why they signed him in the first place. So, is one of the business directives, one of the key business priorities to make sure that Ronaldo is front and centre and there's a lot of talk about him and the social is high and everybody gets their little bit of Ronaldo pie? Like, difficult for Ranieri to come in and say, oh, I'm not playing him.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you're quite right. It's not just a tactical issue. It's an ego issue, and even Real Madrid by the end became. I'm saying even Real Madrid as though Real Madrid and Manchester United are not sort of comparable clubs. But you saw at Real Madrid that they become FC Ronaldo by the end, and Ronaldo's needs and Ronaldo's whims become the dominant force. And whatever coach does with Ronaldo, whether he plays him, whether he asks him to play wide, whether he uses him from a bench, if he rests him for a little while, if he drops him, all of those are huge decisions. And they become massively hyped up. And if Rangnick's somebody who doesn't like that public confrontation and publicly discussing things, that's a huge problem straight away. I think the relationship between Ronaldo and Zidane have become fractured at the end at Real Madrid, and both of them end up leaving the club. But then at Juve, he's burned through three coaches. He burned through Allegri, whose record was excellent. Sarri, I mean, again, Ronaldo's football and Sarri's football, to use your word, are not simpatico. And then Pirlo, who obviously is his first season in as a manager, found it very hard to deal with him. But yeah, Pirlo's final game, what does he do? He drops Ronaldo, because by his final game, when he knows he's leaving, he feels empowered to do that. But I suspect that suggested it's something he'd wanted to do much earlier and hadn't felt able to. And, Michael Carrick dropping him, if it was Carrick, it's easier for Carrick to do it because he knew that was his last game, or as it turns out, penultimate game, but with Rangnick coming in at the weekend.
Jonathan, from a tactical point of view, is there any way of a pressing system succeeding with Ronaldo in the team?
I would say no. And I think it's interesting, Rangnick is on record as saying, and this is when he was at Leipzig 6 years ago, saying he wouldn't sign Ronaldo. However, having said that, I think you can still use him. I just think you can't use him in big games. If you play Ronaldo against Norwich, for instance, he will score goals. Of course he'll score goals. And if you're not particularly worried by the way Norwich play it from the back, and I'm using Norwich as an example, but weaker clubs, lower half Premier League clubs, then he is still a valuable weapon because he is still a great goal scorer. Equally, 20 minutes to go, you're 1-0 down, you're desperate for a goal. Well, Ronaldo's a great figure to chuck off a bench, and he can score all kinds of different goals. He can do something brilliant himself. He can you can stick the ball in the box, he can win the header. The ball might drop to me and lash in a volley. So he's still a powerful weapon to have. And that, I assume, is why City thought he might be a useful player to sign. I mean, I'm assuming here that City did genuinely want to sign him, and that wasn't some sort of
false
flag operation to kind of to lure Manchester United into making this terrible mistake.
Isn't that one of the great sliding doors moments in football history? What would Guardiola have done with Ronaldo right now in the like late stage Ronaldo? That would have been amazing to watch.
It really would have been, yeah, because it was one of those things when I first heard it, like, that can't be true. Surely that's not true, and you're desperately trying to sort of, you know, all these things I thought I understood about football. I think, God, have I got this all wrong? And I still don't know. I'd love to see how that functioned. I suspect it would have been a bit like the Zlatan Ibrahimovic Guardiola link up at Barcelona, where it just didn't really work out and they ended up falling out quite badly. But I'd still like to see it.
Yeah. I do feel like that was somehow a city-state decision as opposed to a football Guardiola decision, and that he would have just... Graham Hunter made the point, he's constantly talking about being an employee at the club and he just does what he's told, and maybe you've got to make Ronaldo work because it's going to help us to, you know, that's why we got involved in football, kids, so that you would forget about all the other things that are going on in the world. In terms of how you expect Ranić's side to play football in this next 4 months, 5 months, what will they actually do? How will they line out? What will the formation be, do you think? Is it back to that four and the blocks of two, or will he look at the playing stock and think he can do something different?
I'd be surprised if it's not a back four. I think it'll be a back four. I assume, looking at the squad, looking at how he's played before, it'll probably be a 4-2-3-1. I know that his final season at Leipzig, he tended to play two up front, it tended to be more of a 4-4-2. But in 2015-16, it was more of a 4-2-3-1. And I think you need to get Bruno Fernandes into the team. And I know the last month or so he's not been in great form, but he is their best creative player. So I actually, in terms of formation, it's not going to be that different to what we've seen already. That the back four, two of the holders, so probably in most games, McTominay and Fred, Bruno Fernandes in front of them, then a centre-forward who I think might be Cavani more often than it has been, and probably Ronaldo at times, and perhaps Greenwood or Rashford, depending. Then, yeah, I think we'll see a lot more from Sancho. I think this is a really good news for Sancho. His success at Dortmund came in a very, very structured system under Lucien Favre. That he was very, the way he'd been sort of brought up playing football was, okay, if this player moves here, then I move here. And if I move here, I know he's moving there. And I know that this fullback is coming up on the outside all the time. And it was very, very regimented. And he clearly thrived in that environment. Then suddenly he's chucked in at Manchester United, where under Solskjaer, I don't think there was any of that kind of instruction. Yeah, it was a go and improvise on this. Rangnick will impose that structure. I think we'll see Sancho, who's been getting better anyway, to be fair. You know, the last couple of games have been his best two games at the club. I think Sancho will become a much more central figure. But then the big issue is, I guess, is it Ronaldo? And how does Ronaldo cope with not just the requirement to press, not just the requirement to do defensive running, but also the sense he can't, from an attacking point of view, he can't just do what he wants. He's got to fit in with these attacking structures. And those attacking structures, I think, in the last decade, have become what differentiate the great coaches from the very good coaches. So Klopp, Guardiola, Tuchel, they are very, very good at putting together these coherent attacking structures. Well, yes, there are improvisations there, but the improvisations on a theme that has been laid down. And then you have the slightly older fashioned view of things, your Mourinho's, your Solskjaer's, where it is, I will create the right mindset for you to make the right decisions, but I'm not going to pre-program it.
What about the challenge Klopp raised of not having time between games? You know, that he may have been used to having a bit more time, that the Premier League comes at you so fast, so thick and fast when you're competing on two fronts. How difficult will that be for him?
Yeah, I think it's a major issue. I think it's a problem for any pressing coach taking over in the middle of a season. But this is the worst possible time because you haven't even got League Cup games to give you a bit of a break. You
know, this or an is international the break. They could have done
or international
two weeks
breaks,
ago,
yeah. This is the most relentless part of the English season. And okay, there is the break coming up in January, plus there's the early rounds of the Cup where you maybe play a week inside, and you know he can do more of the work he needs to do with his first team. And Klopp, of course, experienced this. You know, Klopp came in, well, it was a late autumn, and there was that, I mean, that season, Liverpool had that sort of initial surge under Klopp where his personality and his charisma and even, you know, the Brendan Rodgers era had clearly gone slightly off kilter, and just the sort of sense of relief of as a new guy knows what he's doing. But after that first sort of 6 weeks, 2 months, Liverpool ended that season pretty badly because he just didn't have time to put those structures in place. I think it's really interesting Klopp mentions that because he's gone through it. So the fact that, you know, there's a midweek round of games this week, there's a game at the weekend, there's another midweek round of games before Christmas. Then you've got the congestion of the Christmas fixture list. The next sort of five or six games come in, you know, what, 4 weeks. And that is absolutely relentless. So incredibly difficult. You've got maybe one proper training session between each game to try and get very, very different ideas across. So, yeah, I think that is a big difficulty.
Jonathan, the back four that you talk about, is there room in that back four for Bailly? And, those fringe players who might actually improve quickly under a new manager because they've had no confidence and they haven't given any love, who might actually turn out to be perfect for a style where... I don't know enough, but I suspect he plays quite a high line. If you're pressing and you're trying to get the ball back in the first 2.5 seconds, then your defenders need to push up to make sure it feels like you've got 13 players in the field instead of 11. Is someone like Bailly more suited to that than Harry Maguire, who's a bit slower?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of physical characteristics, I'd say he is. And I think that's an issue with Varane as well, that I think there have been times when Varane has looked uncomfortable in a high press for all his other qualities as a defender. And that's the general problem of planning at United, that there's been no sporting director, no director of football laying down the model, conditioning the sort of players you sign. So if I were an opposing manager playing against Maguire and Varane playing high, I would see that as a potential weakness. Bailly's got the great pace. Bailly's one of those players I just don't quite understand that. I sort of became aware of him for the first time the Cup of Nations in 2015 when Cote d'Ivoire won the tournament, and he was brilliant in that tournament. They played a back three. Kolo Touré was sweeping, and it was him and Wilfried Cannon, and the three of them were all excellent. And obviously I knew about Kolo Touré, but the other two I sort of thought, yeah, they could both really kick on and do something hugely impressive. And Bailly, I think Bailly was the better of the two just because he's quicker. But his career at United, there's been some good games, there's been quite a lot of bad games, quite a lot of mistakes. And I don't know if that's just something in him that he doesn't have that capacity to concentrate that you have to as a centre-back, or whether it's to do with the fact he's been chopped and changed so much, he's never really had a consistent partner, he's never really played regularly, and maybe his confidence has been affected. And certainly, I think the own goal against City, if when you're suddenly dropped into a game like that, coming pretty quickly after he'd been left out at Leicester, which was a bewildering decision because Maguire clearly wasn't fit in that game. You think of the first Leicester goal in that game. It's a poor pass out from De Gea, and Maguire just can't push off that injured calf to get to the weak pass quickly enough. And you were sort of watching that thinking, they've given Bailly, what was it, a 3-year contract in the summer. If they had no faith in him, why not just let him go? But if you're giving him a 3-year contract, why are you not playing him in a game when the main centre-back clearly isn't fit? I have sympathy with him because I can see why in that City game, suddenly there's all this chaos going on and he's been thrust in there, but it's been made pretty apparent to him that the manager doesn't really believe in him. So that's a very long-winded way of getting around to, yes, Bailly is quick and that was even more natural fit. Whether he's actually good enough, I'm not sure.
Okay, we will wait and see. On balance, it sounds like you're more positive than negative, but there's definitely some caveats.
Oh, I think it's the most exciting appointment they've made since Ferguson. I guess there's two caveats. The first is we shouldn't really judge anything on what happens between now and the end of the season. If they finish fourth, or they have a run in the FA Cup, or the Champions League, then brilliant, that's a bonus. But actually it's about getting the structures in place, putting the processes in place for next season, the season beyond that. And if you look at the whole history of United, they've had a massive financial advantage over most of English football since Old Trafford was opened in, I'm going to say 1908, but that might be a year out one way or the other. Yeah, I think it is 1907, 1908, I think, was when it was opened. So with those financial advantages, they should have been always able to, if not dominate, at least be competitive in the top sort of five or six, even in the days before massive TV rights and the modern financial structures. And yet the history of the club is frequent frustration, not spending the money particularly wisely, not using those economic advantages, apart from under three visionary managers, under Magnell, under Busby, under Ferguson. They're the only three managers in the history of Manchester United to have won the league, which for a club that's won the league 20 times, it's the most successful club, is an amazing statistic. More managers have won the league with Sunderland than with Manchester United. So, but the key thing for if you're the United board, United directors, what you have to put in place is a structure to make sure you don't have that inconsistency, that when your messiah figure disappears, you're not just left scratching around for another messiah. There's actually something to fall back on. So we've highlighted why it's difficult for Rangnick to impose his philosophy in the next 6 months, partly because of personnel, partly because of timings. But I think we shouldn't get too hung up on that. What's important is what comes afterwards.
Jonathan, that was brilliant. Thanks a million for joining us. Cheers.
Cheers, thank you.
That's Jonathan Wilson there. As we said at the start, the Football Writer of the Year, third time he's won it. You can see why. A Strange Kind of Glory, as Dunphy's book title said. It's mad. I hadn't thought about that. I hadn't heard that said that way. Three managers, they're the only ones who won the league. Okay, three pretty good ones. But it's mad.
Yeah, and the messiah doesn't... Well, I suppose Klopp is probably a messiah figure in Liverpool, but Liverpool also have the infrastructure behind them that supports his. You know, he's got a fairly robust 12 apostles. You know,
he is the messiah, and if like I think Liverpool fans at the moment are celebrating every single win, because when he goes, what happens next?
Well, yeah, that's the challenge for every team, every club, is to be sustainable beyond the manager, and Chelsea have probably managed that better than any club. I mean, I don't. You know, they have the millions and billions of Abramovich, but they've also got a structure, and they've got this like loan system that they have, and they're functioning football. But they've found a way of making football work.
Yeah, and they always have massive strength in depth, because they always have 10 players who are playing Premier League football or European football for in one of the top five leagues that they can get back, or they can buy back if they want. Yeah.
And City have a similar infrastructure behind. I mean, Guardiola's again a messianic manager figure, and when he goes, that will be very interesting what to do. But they do also have, they've built with their resources, which are incredible, basically a football city on the edge of Manchester, and they've got a massive, like they've got a network of clubs now. You know, it's not just City; they're a bit like Red Bull. So that all feeds into being sustainable beyond. And again, it does help when you are backed by a super state. But
yeah. It's really interesting to see exactly what's going to happen.
Yeah.
If you've got thoughts on that, we'd love to hear them. You can get us on 0879 180 180. You can leave a comment on the YouTube stream. Loads of comments coming in on that. We will get to them in just a moment. A reminder, OTBAM brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Now, we're going back to the Republic of Ireland's 11-0 win against Georgia last night in Tala. And I'm delighted to say Chloe Mustaki is with us. Chloe, good morning to you. How are you?
Good. How are you guys doing? Early start.
Yeah, it's every day for us. We must have done something bad in a previous life. What was your expectation before the game? Because I think everybody expected Ireland to win. We were a bit concerned about how they were going to do it, but they managed to blow all of that away. So before the game, just if you can bring us back, what was your main kind of thing looking out for after the previous game where we all felt a little bit deflated?
Yeah, I guess I was hoping to see the girls kind of have a bit of aggression in their play. Obviously, last Thursday was a bit disappointing all around, but you wanted to see the girls kind of bounce back from that and get pretty, you know, a pretty comprehensive win. Now, I don't think anyone could have expected or wished, you know, for an 11-0 win, but, you know, in the end, it's what we got. It's a bit confusing, like, you know, doing some prep work and looking at Georgia before, you know, thinking Sweden only beat them 4-0, which is pretty phenomenal. Now, as I said, last night, you know, on the radio coverage, was it that Georgia, you know, something was going on in the Georgia camp and it just fell apart last night? Or did we really see, you know, everything come together from the past year and a half under Vera? And we really saw the quality shine through from the girls, which you really haven't had a chance to see. So it could have been a combination of both, to be honest. But at the end of the day, you know, we capitalized on a poor performance from Georgia. And it was great to see so many girls on the score sheet and to see so many good performances from girls that, you know, a lot of us have been backing for so many years because we've played with them or against them. And, you know, the fans haven't really been able to see that for whatever reason. So, no, it was a great performance. look hard for Georgia to take that, but it's really encouraging going into the break now, and hopefully we can build on that next year.
Who are you thinking of? Who are you talking about there? Those players in particular who kind of emerged last night, that the rest of Ireland now gets an opportunity to kind of sit up and take notice of?
Yeah, I think, look, our stars for a good while have been the likes of Katie McCabe, Denise. Now, those two, you know, were outstanding last night as well. But you also saw the likes of kind of Ruisha Littlejohn, who, you know, unfortunately for herself, she's been kind of in and out of camp. She's been injured, but her quality on the ball was incredible last night. The likes of Jess Zhu, obviously I would have played, you know, week in, week out with her at Shelburne, but she's a star in the making. And, you know, she needs that confidence and that game time to be able to do it every week and at international standard every week as well. Now, again, we do recognise that Georgia were a poor side, but girls need that opportunity against kind of slightly weaker sides to build that confidence and be able to kind of then play in the bigger games. So, yeah, those girls. And then great to see the likes of Roma and a few others come on and, you know, be able to show their talent too. So it's an opportunity for Veer to get a look at those players and just generally speaking to build that belief and that confidence amongst the squad, because, you know, we have pulled off some good performances recently, but we haven't been able to get goals as much as we'd like to. And, you know, if we want to aspire to be one of those big nations going forward and, you know, and qualify for the World Cup, we need to be scoring goals.
Yeah, look, goal scoring was a massive issue before the Australia game. We were finding it very difficult to score at all, and that has definitely, seems like it's a corner being turned. I think the point you made about, the quality of the opposition, the process behind most of the goals was a good process. We were
yeah.
We were keeping the ball, we were recycling the ball when we needed to. We were only putting the cross in when it had to be put in. We weren't rushing things. There were definitely some horrific errors, defensive errors, that contributed to our goals. But on general, on balance, what we were doing was the type of thing that you need to do again and again and again. And that habit that they're forming seems to be good habits.
Yeah, and I think that's probably why we managed to get 11 goals by Georgia, whereas maybe some of the other teams, like looking at some footage of Sweden, like Sweden hit the bar a few times. Like, I think it was just our night, and sometimes that's just how football goes. You know, Georgia were poor, but also, you know, we just executed well for those 90 minutes and we got the reward, you know. So it was probably on balance a bit of both, as I said. But look, credit to the girls. They were excellent last night. And, you know, they proved that they deserve everything off the field as well, which is great.
Oh, you said, you know, Ireland want to be one of those bigger teams. How much of a mindset shift is that? And how important is it that the team show ruthlessness in a situation like last night, that they keep the foot to the floor for that 90 minutes and keep scoring, even though, you know, some teams might even just ease off at the end and kind of feel sorry for Georgia that this team didn't and they kept going?
Yeah, no, it's definitely something that we haven't really seen with Irish. I mean, with the Irish men's team maybe as well, although I'm probably not best placed to comment on that. But, you know, we've lacked that ruthlessness over the past few years. And maybe it's because, you know, up top we haven't really had that creative flair, you know, or the options to bang in goals as much as maybe some other nations have. But we are definitely building that at the moment. And especially we have so many girls playing abroad, which is, you know, which is hiring the standard for our international squad. So it's brilliant. And we just need to keep being ruthless. You know, we need to make a stamp on, you know, our rankings worldwide, you know, and show other nations that we should be, we should be one of the top nations, at least in Europe anyway. So, you know, that'll take another few years to prove, but we are definitely building something pretty special. And, you know, the quality in camp is so high at the moment. You know, those players who are not in that squad this time around, who would have been kind of, you know, sure choices a year ago. So you can just see the level of the squad that's just getting higher and higher as the months go by. And it's brilliant. I mean, it's competition for everyone, and that's what we want. If we want to be qualifying for major tournaments, we need that sheer competition in every single position.
Chloe, what's your own situation? You did an ACL and were out, I think, for about 18 months with it, and you're back, just won the league with Shells. How is your own form at the moment? Are you dreaming again of being back out there at some point?
Yeah, look, I've been dreaming since I tore my ACL, you know, just, you know, quietly confident that hopefully I'll get back there in the near future. I've only obviously just been back playing games about two and a half months now, and I know myself I have still, you know, a good bit to go, but I'm feeling a lot better now in terms of my play. Obviously, it's kind of come at a time where the season's finished now, so it's not great timing for me, but you know, that's up to me to keep my standards and to keep working away in the background over the off season. I'm looking at potentially, you know, a move back to England only if it's the right, you know, if it's the right club and the right time for me. So obviously my aspirations are absolutely to get back into that Irish team. But I know the quality that there is there, so I'll have to work really hard. But I am ticking away in the background, and look, hopefully I'll get there at some stage.
Am I right in saying you did your ACL in Ireland camp before your debut?
Yeah, well, it wasn't necessarily going to be my debut, but I was hoping to feature, yeah, within that double header. So yeah, the day before our game against Greece, I tore it in training. So yeah, really unlucky. But to be honest, like looking back, I was, you know, managing a lot in terms of a full-time job. I was traveling outrageous amount, you know, to work, to training in London, getting the tube, and like I was pushing my body to the limit, and like in hindsight something had to give. And I look back on that time and I just think, like, what a crazy schedule I allowed myself to have. And I think, you know, if anything, it's kind of taught me a lesson, and you know, to protect my body a bit better. So look, it's kind of, I always say, it's kind of a tough, that bridging gap between amateur football and professional football is such a difficult, it's such a difficult time, whether it be for males or for females, you know, because you're trying to keep up, you know, your finances, but then you're also trying to push yourself physically, you know, to make that step up. So I think, unfortunately, I was just trying to hold out until the summer, and my body, you know, unfortunately, my body gave in before that. Now, it's hard to say when you tear your ACL, is it because of external factors? But I do think that played a big part. So, look, it is what it is. And unfortunately, it took me quite a long time to get back from, you know, from the tear, from the rehab, for whatever reason. But I'm back now, still working away, obviously, on bits to keep up, you know, to keep being able to play, doing my rehab in the background. I don't think that's going to change for a while, unfortunately. But I'm determined and I'm focused, and definitely getting back to kind of a high level of playing, whether that be, you know, staying here or going back to England. But definitely, you know, getting back into the Irish squad is something that I'd like to do kind of in the near future. So.
I can see how exciting it must be to be on the verge of that, and how bittersweet it must be to watch nights like last night, where you're like, yeah, I could definitely have filled my boots.
Yeah. I was thinking, like, it would have been a good opportunity for, you know, for the likes of myself, but also the likes of the girls that did come on. Obviously, Roma, Kira Grant, obviously, Saoirse getting another cap. You know, unfortunate that maybe, I think we only made four subs. I was looking, you know, reflecting after, we only made four subs, I think. Would have been nice for a fifth player to get on, you know, given the scoreline. So I think it's always just for the amount of work that girls put in to make it, you know, to make it into the squad. I don't think some people realise that sometimes, and you know, even to just have given, you know, that fifth player a few minutes would have just been nice. But anyway, Vera has her reasons, and I know, you know, these things aren't black or white. So yeah, it definitely was bittersweet for me, but I have to just keep focused and keep working away, and hopefully it will pay off.
Well, listen, we wish you the very best of luck with whatever comes next. Congratulations on the recovery and on the league title. Great to talk to you this morning, Chloe. Cheers.
Yeah, thank you so much, guys.
Chloe Moustaki there with a really interesting backstory. I can only imagine how heartbreaking it is to be so close and then to do your ACL and the recovery. I think it was a full 18 months out before she ended up kicking a ball again in anger again.
It's tough to see. It's kind of sad that she feels like she might have to leave to kind of get back to that level that, you know, you would hope that the FAI are looking at the crowds that are going to the games and the interest that's coming, and looking at how they can maybe learn from the mistakes of the men's game and build something, you know, a league here that can harness that interest.
Like, you know, centrally contracted players, maybe?
Potentially. Like, there's definitely models there that you can follow. There's mistakes that, you know, there's mistakes and pitfalls that the Men's League of Ireland have gone down that they can learn from and build something that maybe can keep the best players. You know, obviously, look, if there's better money available and better standard available in England, you will always lose players to there. But there's no reason to say Ireland can't have some sort of a good professional league at some stage. I know it's going to take a lot to build, but it does seem like there's a growing and untapped market for women's sports in Ireland, and rugby is certainly not filling that gap. So, you know, could you potentially build a women's football league that actually does get bums on seats and competes on a weekly basis? Because there are certainly a lot of kids there last night from the sound of things. There are people who are interested. There are sponsors looking to get involved. There seems to be a queue of sponsors to get involved in women's sport at the moment. So you know, you would like to think that if a player doesn't want to go away, that they can still play for Ireland while living here.
And there's loads of different models that you can use. You can have a games promotion officer, the games development officers that the GAA use, where those are, in some instances, they are county players who are also full-time employees of the GAA. Like, the FAI could definitely start looking at that for some of those, and I'm sure they're already doing it, so we're not teaching them how to suck eggs here. But whatever needs to be done to help get players who are on the fringes of the squad into full-time training or a work-life balance that will allow them to train like professionals and to get enough rest and recuperation so they're not doing their ACLs, then they should definitely be doing it. A reminder, OTBAM brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Give it to Mancini. That would be very, very entertaining, says Connor Joyce. For Liverpool fans, I think Mancini might be underrated as a manager, but I'm not sure that him working in the Manchester United scenario that we've outlined on the show today, where there's like a giant brain organising everything and there's a trio of people who Mancini needs to keep happy while also keeping the fans and the ego of the players happy, that's a tough gig.
Well, we've had two people who are very close to, well, one is very close to the story and one who watches these things being built, you know, is an expert on these things being built, and neither of them have any idea how this is going to work. So is anyone being set up to succeed here? Like, is Ragnar being set up to succeed? If Mancini comes in, is he going to be set up to succeed? It seems like there's so much drift in that club that it's going to take some job to get back there. And you know, like Mancini, again, like that Italy team played great football. And he's won a league with City, so there's no reason to think that he couldn't succeed. But
Colin Buick was suggesting that Ralph Hasenhüttl might be the next Manchester United manager, that Ranić comes in and he's the technical director, and it's somebody like Hasenhüttl who understands the Premier League, knows exactly what it's like to play Thursday, Monday, League Cup, another league game, FA Cup, and whatever the vagaries of Stoke on a Tuesday night are going to be, but actually totally gets that style of football that they're trying to do. The reaction immediately was like, well, he's not a big enough name. You're like, but Pochettino had his job before, and now Pochettino is the only manager you're lusting after.
But Pochettino had to go to Spurs to become the guy that Manchester United wants. So there's another stepping, like, Spurs fans won't let me saying this, but there's another stepping stone along the way. It's a, you know,
European experience.
Ten Hag or someone like that who has, you know, done wonders at Ajax. That's the profile of manager where he's actually, maybe, you know, you can't go from keeping Southampton up on a yearly basis to managing Man United. On paper you can, but we all know there's 60,000-70,000 people in the stadium that are going to turn on you as soon as things go wrong, and they're not going to think about the club hierarchy and the fact that you're Ragnar's man. They're going to turn against you.
But what
you.
If it's the right thing from a football perspective? What if actually, so what you're saying is this guy's style of play, if he had better players, would be far more effective at the top level than the I'm going to give you the eye of the tiger and I'm going to put you.
But football doesn't exist in isolation. Everything else factors in. You got to, like, is Ronaldo going to be listen to Ryan, like to
Ronaldo's
to these
not
people.
Going to be there next summer. After the, I am 100% certain that something is going to crop up that Cristiano decides an opportunity is too big to turn down, and it's like everybody saves face. I don't know what that is just yet. I haven't quite worked out. I mean, it could be Barcelona.
I mean, if Ed Woodward or Richard Arnold are making the decisions and they're looking at the numbers of the things that they find important, are they going to let Ronaldo walk? Are they going to go, well, you've got a year left in your contract and you're 30 odds. You know, we're going to harvest every bit of data we can get out of you in the next year. Saw the results. We'll still finish in the top half of the table, and there'll be another season next year, and we can get another superstar manager in. You're going to be retired soon. We're going to get everything we can out of you, and that is the problem, because the people making the football decisions are not in charge.
That is a very likely scenario. I confess that is a, you know, it could be 50-50, but this is what's up for grabs. Do they decide that what we're going to try and do is not have the system that Jonathan Wilson spoke about, which is the three managers who've won us everything, and it's a messiah who comes in and fixes everything, or we're just going to have a system that harvests the league title every two or three seasons? Because that's what we should be doing with our financial might.
What is Manchester United? It's a money-making vehicle for an American family and a giant entertainment company.
Which would make you more money? I think the regular success would make
you
more money.
They're quite happy with the amount of money they're making at the moment. And
yeah,
they don't
everybody
really
else wants more, especially when you get to that level.
Yeah, well, they get their trophies off the books, don't they? So they're quite happy to live in that world. I just don't think there's the will is there to... I just think Ragnar could get chewed up by this and spat out and get another consultancy job somewhere else. But
that's
he doesn't
very
need
possible.
The hassle.
Yeah.
There's too many competing interests at that club, and maybe he's the man. Maybe he's the man to go, look, I'll run your football side. You guys worry about the marketing teams. But as soon as they present him with signings like Ronaldo, you know, nostalgia signings that don't fit into a system, he's just going to go, I don't need this. I go back to Moscow and, you know, or back to Red Bull. I mean, there's money elsewhere in the game. You don't need the hassle. And what Jonathan said about he didn't enjoy the Schalke profile. Well, I mean, good luck, buddy.
This is going to get very interesting. That part of it, I think, is also going to be very interesting because he did, at different stages, leave jobs because of that. If Ranić isn't given the power he needs for this project, it'll fail, says Zakir. And if he's given a lot of players who might have to play for their future, otherwise they'll be out very soon. It is about power. A lot of people complaining about us covering Manchester United this week. It's not like it's, you know, they've just had one of their very few managerial changes, but okay. Ahir, not more United discussion, says Justin. And Dahi goes, this show's basically turned into off the United ball. We will definitely be doing Harriet Pryor on the show tomorrow for a Merseyside derby debrief, and we'll be talking about loads of other stuff. We're going to talk rugby in just a couple of minutes too as well. Conor Joyce says, signing Ronaldo was the most reckless, nostalgic decision made by United. Yes, huge benefits commercially as seen by the hysteria upon his arrival, but it did not match to where the team was going. They had four very good front players, Rashford, Greenwood, Cavani and Fernandes, had just signed Sancho but blew all of that out of the water by signing Ronaldo. What would Guardiola have done with Ronaldo? Like, what would he have done?
He did sign. Wasn't it Maxi Lopez he signed for Barcelona? He signed Ibrahimovic for Barcelona. He does like to have an alternative that he can bring on. But I think he would have been an impact sub.
I think Zlatan still scores 40-odd goals for that Barcelona team.
That's true, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it would have been fascinating to see how he fits into that system and whether they can make it work. And you would think that Guardiola has the star power. But he's got such history, you know, of being on opposition sides. Like, Ronaldo would respect his results, you would think. But at the same time, he's the Barcelona guy. I wonder how that relationship would have worked.
Well, watching the game at the weekend, you're like, when they sign Haaland, if they sign Haaland, this team is going to be unstoppable because they created a gajillion chances and just couldn't score. And they did obviously win 2-0 against the team who were fourth or third at that stage in the table. So forget about CR7. How does Maguire, with all the pace of a dead snail and turning circle of a bendy bus, fit into Ranić's system?
It's like late stage John Terry, isn't it? John Terry and Gary Cahill being turned relentlessly.
Why doesn't anyone talk about that? Well, we did talk about that, and I think that Maguire is going to get dropped for bye. That's my prediction. That's my wild prediction. From our YouTube channel, there's an early piece on Ranić. You should check that out. Uli Hess was on last night, the author of Tor. The great news was that he's got an updated version of his history of German football out. He was talking with Joe about it. It's an absolutely astonishingly good football book. It's the full history of German football. I think he first wrote that in like the early 2000s. So he's got a new publisher and it's been updated. Get it for Christmas if you like people and they like football. You should get that book. Mark Shirley says, I think the Glazers will be happy to have a dominant character running the club. It's what they've needed since Sir Alex Ferguson retired. Obviously, Mark, SAF. Since Ferguson retired. Do they want that? Maybe they do. Maybe they want someone who just comes to them and says...
For them, I think they look at the balance sheet and whatever. As long as the money's coming through, they're quite happy. But I think there's enough chefs between them and the football side who think they know what they're doing and are self-important enough to build something. And they feel like... it sounds like people like Richard Arnold think they're creating something new and exciting as a brand. And, you know, the football doesn't necessarily, like, it feeds into their brand rather than being the front and centre of the brand, and that must be so frustrating for fans of the club.
Yeah, are the fans addicted a little bit to the soap opera? Are they? Is that like, you know? So I follow most of the football clubs on Twitter, and the fan base that I follow the most closely would be the Villa fan base. And in fairness, the social account constantly gets asked for training snaps. Give us the pictures from training, give us the pictures from training. And so they do send the pictures from training. But the week that Solskjaer got sacked, reports on the five-a-sides came out. So, and there was a celebration picture after one of the five-a-sides with a team who'd won the five-a-side in training that week. I was like, this is wrong. We're not supposed to know who won the five-a-side. Like,
when your fan base is as broad and varied as Manchester United's global fan base is, then there's so many competing interests within that. There is the people who just want the jersey at the end of the day, or who just want, you know, I think they've profiled it. You know, they have their haters, and they, you know, they value them just as much as they value, because they click as well. But there are the people who go to the matches, and there's the people who pay for Sky Sports and BT subscriptions, and they want to win, and they want to see their team winning, and they've been raised on it. Like they're going through exactly what Liverpool fans went through in the 90s, except for there's millions more of them, and that there is a contingent. Like, I mean, you know, I'm a Bohemians fan. I'm going through the pits this week because my club didn't win the first trophy in 13 years the other day. There are people like me who support Man United. I know a guy who lives in Donegal but still goes with a season ticket every week, he doesn't care about he experiences the drama of it, and I'm sure he lives it all the time, but at the end of the year he wants a Premier League trophy because he was raised on a diet of Premier League trophies.
So they shouldn't have taken that for granted. I have limited sympathy, but
sympathy, because that's football. I mean, football is misery,
and it's supposed to be. And I think that actually, I don't know, maybe they're right. Maybe being addicted to the drama and the soap opera is like you're alive, you're watching something that is constantly changing, and it's far more exciting than actually when they were winning every game 3-0 and games were over when teams were just turning up. Like, I don't know. Would the Liverpool fans now appreciate Klopp as much if they hadn't had the catalogue of misery that they had between the end of Kenny Dalglish the first time and Klopp arriving the second time?
No, but when they're in the midst of that misery, they were miserable. They won a Champions League in the middle of it, so it wasn't that bad.
Misery. No. Aren't you and your Bose supporting mates a little bit closer this week because of the misery?
No, I don't think it's a good. It's not. Well, certainly my wife would tell you that she's not enjoying the misery because I barely talked to her in 3 days. But when it goes on for years and it's like there's the hope that you'll get there. But at the moment, the United are at this point where they're like, I don't think my club actually wants to win for me anymore. You know, they just want to produce content for me, and I think that's. You know, and there's so much mixed stuff going on. And of course you can enjoy it. And you enjoy the win. You beat Arsenal tomorrow night. They'll enjoy that high. It's a cheap thrill.
Yeah.
It's getting the consistency. And the Liverpool fans who are going every week particularly are seeing their team at their optimum. City are the same.
And getting better
and
better.
This is their glory time. But the thing is when your team is doing that, you got to enjoy it because you just don't know what's coming around the corner.
No, and I think the whole point about actually really loving any of your sport is that there are going to be bad times and you have to learn to live with the defeats and actually not enjoy them but enjoy being part of that whole thing, because like you can't have the victories without the defeats. This is a zero sum game when it comes to one team wins and one team loses, and if the result is all that matters, then you're never going to be fully happy even when you do win, because at some point you're going to lose and you know that's coming. So like it's actually loving the ups and downs of the thing that you're supposed to embrace. And I don't know, maybe Man United fans will look back on this as a golden period of narrative. What would have happened if there'd been VAR at the game at the weekend?
Sure. I'm convinced that the ball went over the line when Rory Feely headed the ball towards the goal. And the Thai man would have been a brother of a Kildare footballer, comes off the bench and scores two goals to win the cup for Bohemians. What a story.
What stage of the game is this for anybody?
This is about 2 minutes to go in extra time. And
so you're right in line with it?
I'm right above it.
Right.
Look, there's I would say inconclusive footage out there that if you believe...
Cruder film.
If you believe, yeah. And I'm telling you what I saw at the time and I'm convinced it went in, but people who are neutral are saying to me, you're absolutely off your head.
We should get goal line technology for the cup final, shouldn't we?
I think, yeah, if you have if the facilities in the stadium, if the Viva Stadium can do it, then yeah. I think you should. At least then, people like me could be silenced. But for, I'll be like backing to the left for forever about this one. So it would have been nice to have it. But yeah, unfortunately, it wasn't to be.
Okay, so, shouldn't have brought that up.
No, it's okay. It's okay. Well, Pats are in their own misery as well. Like, Pats are learning that football is misery this week as well, because they're losing the manager to Dundalk, in the days after they finally felt like they were building something.
Takes a bit of the gloss off it, all right,
absolutely,
doesn't it?
Yeah.
Shut the F up until he comes in. You guys are killing Ronaldo's career with propaganda here and there, says Sam Houston.
That will be okay.
Coming back to United is a legendary sacrifice he made, but fans fail to see it. For $40 million a year, he's sacrificing a lot. Ranić's philosophy is exactly the same as Ferguson, but spoken in a German tone. Ferguson always said his players had to try and win the ball, to track back, to fight for one another. It's not rocket science. What it means is everyone in the team works hard. Just ask Roy Keane, says John McElroy. It's a little bit more complicated than you all get out there and work hard, which doesn't seem to have worked very much for Solskjaer, because some of the players didn't work hard and they weren't called up on it, and there didn't seem to be a matrix for them to follow. Right, here's what's on OTB Sports Radio today. At 10:30, it's live, the GAA Club Championship show with AIB. Will, Tommy, Brian McGrath, Lockmore, Castellini and Cara O'Kane previewing the Ulster Club Football Championship. OTB Gold today is Dr. Harry Edwards talking about OJ and the OJ documentary. He's actually in the ESPN Oscar-winning documentary series about OJ Simpson. The Koi Gig Pod is a reaction to last night's 11-0 victory. Our retro panel at 4 o'clock is How Far Does Doping Go? OTB Gold at 6 is Catherine Switzer from the 67 Boston Marathon, where she competed even though women weren't allowed. And 7 o'clock live tonight, more reaction and analysis to the game last night and plenty more as well. We're going to bring you Wednesday's papers and we're talking rugby with Rory next.
OTB AM.
Rory is still with us. We're going to talk rugby. The Munster situation is evolving. They're due to land in Schiphol in an hour. They're going to somehow make it from there back to their homes, and they'll sit in their rooms for 10 days trying not to waste too much, and then a portion of them will end up playing in the Champions Cup. But what happens the league?
Well, I think it's been the kind of bubbling under story, because the getting Munster home has been the front and centre of the story this week for understandable reasons. And now that they are largely home, there's still 14 of them still there, and Cardiff will also get back. I think on Thursday they're leaving, so they're still in South Africa, but they're coming back on Thursday. The question then becomes, what's the future of the URC? What's the immediate future of the URC? Apparently the South Africans are raging because they came over to Europe for 5-6 weeks and played games and did their bubbles and went and supported each other in Wales and kind of lived this life. And at the first sign of trouble, in their view, the European teams tucked and ran. And they feel like that more effort should have been made to get those games across the line, even behind closed doors at the weekend. Now, with the number of cases, you struggle to see how that could have happened. But they're pretty feeling pretty marginalised anyway after the summer and the Lions and the Razzie stuff. And they feel they're not feeling much love. So they're pretty important stakeholders in all this. So if they're annoyed, that's a problem. You've also got this prospect of all of the other provinces, plus Munster now, are fixed. The plan, I think, is to play these URC games that have been abandoned in the spring window during the Six Nations.
Okay.
So Munster are going to be asked to get another squad of 48 or so players and management and go back to South Africa, including probably some of the people who are still there, for 2 weeks to play two games, which in normal times would be lovely,
obviously,
without their internationals. But even just for a prospect of a player who's stuck in a hotel now, are you going to tell your wife and kids that, look, I'm going back there? And it's not like a trip to Italy where you go to Zebre the day before the match, you play in Parma and you fly home that night. This is a 2 week stint, and we see with COVID things change so quickly. Omicron just appeared and suddenly borders were shut. So like, that's a hard sell for players. I'm sure Leinster, Ulster and Connacht are looking at this. The South Africans are supposed to be here over Christmas. Like, I think Leinster play the Lions or the Stormers just before the Heineken Cup round 3 in January. There is so much at play here. Like, will they be allowed to travel? You know, they'll have to get dispensations to come across. And it's just, the logistical challenge of playing a tournament across 5 public health jurisdictions, including one which is a 10-hour flight away, is difficult, as is, you know, in normal times. But during a pandemic, it was always going to be ambitious to pull it off. And we're seeing that now. And I struggle to see how they, unless they rejig the format and do a conference system or something, you know, where each team plays in each other's regions, and then you have playoffs at the end of the year when things are a bit better and the weather's nicer and hopefully numbers are down. I struggle to see how they pull it off as it's currently constituted, but we're 6 rounds in. So how do you abandon? Do you just strike off those 6 rounds? I don't envy them. And it's not a huge organisation, the URC. It's not like the Premier League or even the English Premiership, which has, you know, years and years of experience. It's quite a stripped back organisation, the URC, and it needs to be bulked up over the next couple of years in terms of the infrastructure behind it. So there's a small number of people making these decisions. There's unions, there's all sorts of people at play. There's doctors, I'm sure, involved as well. It's tricky. I don't know. And the South Africans are supposed to come into the European Cup next year. So this is supposed to be their vehicle to qualify for next year's European Cup. So that's another issue as well. So it's messy.
It is messy, and it's difficult, and you wish them all the best with it. It's not a problem that there's an obvious solution to. But there won't be games. You'd be very surprised if there were games with South African teams in them this side of the Six Nations, really, given everything that's going on. Like, we keep hearing about more strenuous, the kids are being asked to wear masks in school, and we're like, no, come on, you can bring a couple of teams over, that's fine. And I'm sure that they could bubble and they could have charter flights, and it was only them on the flights, and everybody would be tested, PCR tested on the flights, before the flights, the day after, to make sure that nothing happened. And I'm sure it's doable, but who else gets the derogations then?
Well, I take that point. I think sport has been given, you know, elite sport has been lucky in that it's been given exemptions heretofore, and I don't see why that wouldn't continue. But if you're a South African player and you live in, I mean, look, it's your livelihood, so eventually you'll do what you're told. But even a South African administrator is going, well, why are we going over there for 5 weeks when they wouldn't stay for two? And we don't see it that way because they're Munster players and we know them and we can empathise with what they've gone through, I think. And, you know, the idea of being stuck over there is pretty grim. But those South African players are sacrificing an awful lot to keep the show on the road.
Yeah.
And they're going to be reluctant to travel as well because they may get stuck in Europe and not be able to get home for their families.
And in fairness, maybe it would be different during the window for the Six Nations in that you would have a separate squad of players who are not available to you anyway because they will be playing for the Ireland team in the Six Nations. Like, do you now need two squads where you can send one to South Africa that'll be good enough to compete against the best teams in South Africa away from home
with the Springboks who'll be available at that point?
And you'll also need to fix the current situation, right? To tease out what the South African unrest and unease is about. Could Munster have stayed there? Yeah, they could have stayed there, but then they wouldn't have been able to fulfil their European Cup fixture. That's the problem, isn't it?
Yeah.
If in advance they'd been told you're going to have to quarantine for 2 weeks, you'd send a team, they would go for 2 weeks, you'd keep your strongest team. Like, it's not ideal, but to keep the show on the road, that's what you had to sacrifice in advance. Maybe they would have done that, maybe they wouldn't have done that, I don't know.
It's a big squad and there's less fixtures this year. We've had 5 weeks off and they played one round of A games and players have been playing AAL, and like, there's guys currently within the Leinster have the biggest squad and which traditionally have used 50, 55, 60 players across the season, not traditionally, but in the last couple of years, because there's so many games in different windows, that's gone now. So you're keeping players really for two games in a season. It's not really realistic and sustainable. So there's, I think they will come up with a secondary competition, a kind of a BNI Cup or a URC Cup, where they will get those players games to keep them interested across the season. But to be able to do that, I don't see that as being realistic. I don't think it's a good idea, really. And I mean, it's short term. You'd hope that this will clear and we will go back to just being able to come and go as we please from other countries. But there's no guarantee that it's going to ever be able to happen again. But if you're committing to a cross-hemisphere competition involving 10-hour flights, there are going to be logistical issues. Trying to tally that with playing in Europe at the same, you know, a week later, it was a difficult enough challenge for Munster to fly back from South Africa and go straight into the first round of the Heineken Cup. Like, they lost the European Cup semi-final a couple of years ago on the back of 2 weeks in South Africa when they turned up against Racing 92 and didn't perform, having played, you know, like, and you've got to think the travel played a part in that. And that's, you know, Super Rugby teams have been doing this for years, but it's a new challenge for us. And look, it's a weird league. It doesn't really make any sense. You would never have set out and designed a league involving Welsh, Scottish, Irish, Italian and South African.
But they
teams.
Did, in a way.
But it's whoever's left.
Yeah.
It's all, like, no one wants us. Like, ideally, we'd be in a British and Irish league and we'd be playing against Leicester and Bath.
So Keith Wood's been talking about a Lions league for years.
Of no interest.
But, like, is there no money that would convince them? Is there not, like, a...
They have their thing. The French love, like, that. The Premiership has a tradition and it has a history, and sometimes I find it weird that they're so obsessed by it, and the French are the same, but they have.
And in fairness, it has
something.
Become a much better league. Like, yeah. It was really boring for about 8 or 9 years, and over the last couple of years, the rugby has vastly improved, and the style of play has vastly improved. Kind of like Gaelic football, shit for a decade. All of a sudden, the attacking comes to the fore, and
just like we love our derbies, like they quite enjoy Leicester playing Bath and Leicester playing Northampton, and they don't see any reason why they want to play the Scarlets. And like, you might. Like having, well, I mean, Leinster will probably come in and quite win the thing started. So I mean, you're kind of voting for Christmas there as well. But you also would have games against Dragons and games against. They don't see Connacht as a, you know, I'm insulting an entire province here, but they wouldn't see Connacht as a draw, and they would see it as a bit of a pain in the ass to have to go to Galway every couple of months.
Yeah.
And that's a sell. Like, you know, do they want Zebre and Treviso in their league?
No.
You kind of can't cherry pick Leinster, Munster and Ulster and maybe the Scarlets. Like, that's what they'd like to do, maybe, but they're quite happy playing each other. They don't want to, that's why we have this strange unloved competition that I think is better with the South Africans in it from a quality point of view and
definitely.
An interest point of view.
Yeah.
But logistically, it becomes teams. Yeah, but the four that are there can be great and it could be a very good competition. But it's such a logistical nightmare.
It has become a complete nightmare. Let's talk about the Connacht performance last weekend in weather that was fairly similar to what was in Tala last night. Even worse, actually. And on the back of the performance the previous time out against Ulster, there's something really brewing in Connacht, and every time you listen to Andy Friend, he's taking all the blame, he's taking all the responsibility for anything that bad that happens, and he's given all the credit for all the good stuff that happens to his coaching ticket and his players. And I always have any dealings with him, you come away feeling, well, I definitely would like to play for him. He's like, and says all the right stuff, but then his teams are starting to back it up on a consistency basis. It's like, that's an incredible job he's doing at the moment.
Absolutely. He's very impressive. He's very likable, and he's the kind of coach, and they're the kind of setup a little bit like when Leicester won the Premier League in 2016. They make everyone else look bad because they're doing it with much worse resources in a worse stadium and worse. They played rugby on Friday night in the worst conditions I've experienced. I was down there, and I would argue with Nathan that maybe the Connacht's conditions on Friday night were the worst I've seen in a long time, and they scored 7 tries. One of which was a penalty try, but that was also, they were all through their backs, and it was all through incisive attacking play. Even the penalty try was a player, you know, cutting around and, I mean, being forced into touch with an illegal tackle. It was incredible. And like the Irish football team last night, you do have to take the fact that the Ospreys were not very good, but it was pretty much the same Ospreys team who beat Munster. Didn't fancy it in the wet night in Galway, but still they had to be beaten. And they had Connacht had a debutant centre who was 19 or 20, Shane Bolton. They've signed from South Africa. Not mapped. Wasn't in any of the Super Rugby franchises. They identified him, Irish qualified, signed him. And they had Orrin McNulty playing a fullback who's making his first start, former Ireland under 20 player who's from England initially, but is Irish qualified, and he scored a try, and it was his first start, and he had the courage of his own convictions because he'd been backed by these coaches to go and play in the worst conditions possible. I was so impressed by it, and Andy Friend gives a lot of credit, particularly to Pete Wilkins, who's his senior coach. So that's the same role as Larkham and Stuart Lancaster, albeit with a much lower profile. And he's a very impressive person. He did press yesterday. Really good talker, really good clarity around what he wants the players to do, and very much they're being empowered. He was their defence coach, and okay, he's been promoted, and now he has responsibility.
There was a shake-up with the backroom team
The two kind of homegrown guys left, Jimmy Duffy and Nigel Carolan, who's now at Glasgow, and he stepped up, and Friend has kind of gone more kind of umbrella view of the whole organisation, and Wilkins has taken over as the on-field.
Right.
I mean, Friend still has a huge influence. Wilkins, it really interesting, English guy, went to Australia, worked in Australian Super Rugby franchises as an analyst and as a coach, and got spotted by Friend, brought to Ireland by Friend. Not a huge profile, but very intelligent. One of these, a bit like what you kind of hear about Ragnick and all these people, like kind of a self-made coach who didn't have the playing career. And he's doing a really, really good job, and the players really like it, and they really buy into it, and they have a clear identity of how they want to play. They are trying to move away from the inconsistency, because what they used to do was have these big one-off games, apart from 2016, and then they wouldn't back it up, and that's why they were so happy with Friday night, because an Ospreys at home was the kind of game that they would have let slip, and they have lost to the Dragons there already. But they're very impressive. I think they'll give Leinster a good rattle on Friday night.
It's going to be a very interesting game, because Leinster have to pick a strong team. Like, they have to get their team that they want to play, or the majority of the team that they want to play, and start Ireland. The game.
The Ireland team, yeah, basically. Yeah. Minus one or two Munster players. Yeah, no, they do. And
who's injured at the moment.
They're playing Bath next week. Yeah, Ryan Sexton, Gibson Park. So it's not the full whack. But you're bringing in Ross Byrne. You're bringing in Ryan Baird. You're bringing in...
Bringing in Ross Byrne. Not Harry Byrne.
No, definitely Ross Byrne at the moment, yeah. Well, for Europe, I don't think there's a debate on that in Leinster at the moment. Like, Harry Byrne came off the bench against Ulster, didn't play well. He's played twice for Leinster this season. He got 20 minutes against Zebre as a starter and got injured that day. But before he came off, he had a really poor game, made a lot of mistakes. And then he came off the bench to replace his brother against Ulster on Saturday and made an awful lot of mistakes as well. His best performance was that half an hour against Argentina. But that was a fairly beaten Argentina team by then. They were down to 14 men for a while, and he got to enjoy himself in front of a big crowd. He's an awful lot of proving to do. Like, I really rate him. I really think he's a very good player. But at some stage, he's going to have to come off the bench for Ross and kill Ross. Like, he's got to go, that's not my brother, that's my rival, and come off the bench and just end Ross's chances.
Run a game.
Well, beat Ulster. You know, and he didn't do that. Like, that was a good Leinster team last Saturday night, and they didn't play like a good Leinster team. Not that Ross played particularly well either, but I just think Ross is still very much ahead of him in that team.
We don't know the teams yet, as we're talking right now on Wednesday morning. What you expect the full Leinster team for
this? Well, they're kicking off the European campaign next week, so I would fully expect as strong as they can go with the injuries that they have, because they need a dry run before that game. They'll rest lads. Like the players all got a little bit of a holiday after November. It's still very early in the season, so I wouldn't expect any player management issues at this point. So
okay.
It's a really good test for that Connacht team. Leinster have lost four times in the RDS in 2021.
Leinster are 17-point favourites for that game. It doesn't
seem 15 against Ulster.
That doesn't seem to make that much sense.
No, but they do have the capacity. Like, they absolutely blew Connacht away in the sports ground. When they get it right, like, they beat the All Blacks effectively, you know. I mean,
they're
I mean
good
trite. They are very good.
Team.
They have a lot
yeah.
of very, very good yeah. players.
It's just so, that Connacht, that, I don't know, feels like Connacht are building to a performance, and this would be a good, really good test.
Tight five-wise, Leinster could blow anyone away in this league. And if Porter, Kelleher and Furlong are on the pitch, that's very hard to play against, and that could be the difference between the teams. But I wouldn't discourage anyone from that. Taking on that spread, I think that's quite generous.
All right, Rory, good stuff. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, sure.
OTBAM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Owen's back in studio tomorrow. We're going to hear from Harriet Pryor after the Merseyside Derby. We'll have rugby and much more as well.
OTB AM with Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.